It is Sunday, September 1st, 2024. This is the day that Hitler invaded Poland, back in 1939. 9:55 p.m., Bungalow C, Saturday Juice Room, Melrose, Massachusetts. This is Joko Literigo meeting number 164. Oh. It is the second for the year, which is a good trend.
Definitely.
A number of things to say. First of all, a Joko meeting, well, I guess it was scheduled for August. It's happening in September. It reminds me of the story I recently heard with a guy who played for two teams in the same game. And the way it happened was that when he played on the first team, the game was called due to rain. It didn't complete. It was an incomplete game. They had to make it up. By the time they come around to make up the game, he'd been traded to the other team.
That's funny.
That was the first time in baseball history that happened. He was Red Sox, at least on one side or other of that trade.
That's funny.
What was the point of that?
The date.
Oh, right. So this meeting was scheduled for August, but it's happening September. September meetings, of course, happen, or at least used to happen a lot. August meetings don't happen hardly ever. There was no June meeting. It's sort of a sequence of events that one can roughly tie together. The first thing about 2024 is I have a better job.
Definitely.
And this year was a couple of things that I wanted to do well by, I think is probably the best phrase. First, my birthday, I turned 60 in April. And second, my 25th anniversary of my first time going to Burning Man is this year. And so toward the one, I vowed that I was going to do a lot more work on everything, writing and press, all the projects that I do, and just catch things up that hadn't been caught up, do things that hadn't been done for a while. And one of the things that had to be done is I had to get back on track with the Cenacle. I think the April Cenacle ended up being a little bit late, but it happened, which was good. And then I decided to let the June issue be a summer issue, and that began to elide into the next thing, the Burning Man thing, because I realized I and or we could not go because of the global pandemic, which is still going on. We couldn't go, and I found this very frustrating, but the bottom line is that I didn't want to not go again, and I had to figure out how to go a different way. And I'm going to read my notes from the England piece, so I'm not going to go into this too much. But I had to figure out a different way to deal with it.
You did.
And the nice nickel summary of it is I decided in the end that we were going to celebrate Burning Man. We were going to participate in Burning Man here, where this year it's safe. And just to make sure that I wasn't somehow lazing about in the form of this activity, I decided that every single project was going to get updated. And that's pretty much what happened.
It has ensured that there was no lazing about.
It assured. So thus we come to tonight. Tonight is the night of the temple burn, which probably hasn't happened yet. So we're doing this still in the midst of the event. We're still, you know, we had to kind of like zig and zag it a little bit, but we're doing it within the midst of it. I want us to attend Burning Man. I wanted Joko Wheel to be during Burning Man. I want it all to occur as part of this, you know, the climax weekend. It's an all-week thing, but the climax weekend is like the climax. That all said, that is the briefest of summaries of the reason for this meeting tonight or this weekend.
Yep.
Now, we're going to jump back, as we usually do, with Joko Wheel flashbacks. This year, we have one. The single flashback is going to be of me. It's going to be of me talking into a voice journal, very much like the one that's sitting around here somewhere, that one right there. Me at Burning Man 1999 with a voice journal very much like this, walking around on burn night and narrating and recording what I heard and saw. That's going to be our flashback this go round.
Thank you. I'm going to bike across the Playa, which is completely dark, the center area around which all the camps are circled. I'm hoping for the best. This is great. This is fucking incredible. I don't know if the sounds are conveying it. I don't think they can. But they're doing the best they can, I guess. And they're doing what sounds do. If it sounds like an acid trip, it is. I'm tripping. This shit is tripped out. I'm in the middle of the fucking desert. I'm riding a bike on an absolutely lightless fucking desert. Surrounded by fucking lights on all sides and a 50-foot neon fucking man. Silhouetted against a fucking mountain. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a dream. I was reading tonight the Bible in an appropriate place. I was taking a fucking shit. Shit took a while, but it came out alright. I guess that's good. They hurt when they don't come out alright, so there it was. And I'd, Skyped a copy of the Bible from a hotel in Nevada, Wendover, Nevada, way back when. And, I was looking at it. I was curious. This fucking book, what does it mean? And it talks about fucking God creates all this shit. Right? He creates all this shit. And then he creates man. He tries to mate up man with a fucking animal, first of all, which is kind of interesting. He doesn't mate him up with Eve, first of all. He, like, parades all these fucking animals in front of Adam. Adam names all the animals, but deems none of them fit to be his mate. So, sort of ride comprehensively. But what I'm saying is he creates woman and then there's this fucking snake, and I guess this snake's supposed to be the fucking devil. Right? And the snake tempts Eve to eat from the tree of good and evil. And in this fucked up book, knowledge of good and evil means that you want to Knowledge of good and evil means Jesus. Holy shit. It is a huge fucking fire in the distance. It's like a flamethrower, right? Knowledge of good and evil means that you put on clothes, you're ashamed. Shame of the human body is equated with knowledge of good and evil. It's like it's just very perfunctorily fucking laid out there. Eat of apple, God said no. God said no, eat of apple. Right. Apple, you know, is knowledge of good and evil, and good and evil has to do with being naked. And naked is equated with fucking bad. It's like now that we know the difference between good and bad, we know that covering up is the right thing to do because not covering up is bad. Okay. And then they're expelled before they eat of the tree of life and know everything and have immortality too. They're kicked out. Now listen, y'all. This scene, this thing I'm in, is a refutation on every level. of that kind of weird, fucked up bullshit. And that weirdo, fucked up bullshit that keeps us down and keeps us apart from each other and has no value. It has no value. There's no value in saying this. There's no value in saying we're expelled from something because we know good and evil, and good and evil has to do with wearing clothes. I mean, CSNY sang Woodstock, written by Joni Mitchell, about getting back to the garden. And, you know, that's fine. But it's beyond the fucking garden, man. It's like, fucking dispose of that fucking bullshit myth, period. There is no garden to get back to. It's all garden, and none of it's garden. And talking about fucking it being a garden is fucking stupid. This fucking mythical garden we were expelled from for disobedience, essentially, to a fucking, like, a god in the shape of man. Man said no to man, rejected hierarchy, chose his mate over his boss, and got punished. So anyway, I read like 3 chapters of the book of Genesis, and that was pretty much it. That was all I needed to fucking read. You know, that was all I needed to read. It's all fucked. Maybe good as literature, as they say, but it's fucked for any other reason. This is fucking incredible. Stop for a moment. This bike has one brake, but it's a very good brake. It's just like endless numbers of things to see, and what's wonderful is it doesn't end tonight. What's wonderful is everybody who's been before says, basically, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to keep building. How can something this fucking incredible keep building? How can this not be the whole fucking thing? How can this not be just a fucking dream? But it's not a dream. I'm going back to help build a temple of the eternal mysteries, conceived by Chuck Nichols, inspired by this festival last year. I'm fucking lost, I think. No, I'm starting to see things I have seen before. But anyway, this is fucking incredible. It's ridiculous. I've got a good speed going on the bike. And on the brake. Eyes looking around for whatever the fuck there is to see. Try to pay attention. Why can't I do this in a car? I'm feeling so. Oops. Sorry. You're listening to the Within's Within. Scenes from the Psychedelic Revolution. I'm Suleid, your host. Radio Free Cambridge, 106.1 FM. Want to know what it was like at Burning Man? You want to know what it was like on the final night, the night of the burn? Alright. Let's go. Let's go. Now. to dance, I'm going to dance.
Thank you. Last year I felt was fairly well orchestrated, Roger.
Oh yeah.
over there, so you know. You've seen all kinds of shit. Yeah, I mean, Burning Man, Burning Man. Yeah, do you think it's happening here? Okay, anywhere but the States. I don't know about Europe. No, it's nature, the character. The character is very wild west. It's very super-fat culture. Yeah, very cyber-savvy. I think the first thing is psychedelic culture is the final point of destination in the Western Hemisphere. Here's Silicon Valley as a font. Question is, why?
Why?
That's it. Right next to where you, this is closed. It's right in front of the show. Right. 4:30 mark. It went great. It closed by 2,500 people.
Thank you. Right now?
So I'm going to begin with Sulaj Notebooks. September 1st, 2024, 6 p.m., Bungalow C, front porch, rocking bench, Melrose, Massachusetts. Wind chimes twinkle, ours and the neighbors too. Tall trees glitter in the wind. The air is cooling as the late summer's evening murmurs in. Distant drone of a jet. People pass on the sidewalk of various sizes, shapes, and shades. An occasional car swooshes by. An occasional dog barks. Welcome to the summer 2024 issue of The Cenacle. Not too many of these summer issues over the past 29 years of publication. Early years, they were special one-writer double issues. Me, Charette, Amante, Chacone, Burning Man 1999. Recent years, a substitute for a June issue running quite late. This year, this summer issue, not quite for those reasons. As is detailed in this issue's Notes from New England, I wanted to go to Burning Man 2024, including tonight, but the many dangers of the global pandemic made that impossible. So by virtue of purchasing and putting up a little free library here, down on the front of that lawn before me, Burning Man and No Borders Free Bookstore have come here. Funny to be at Burning Man while listening to the music's mix of trees and wind chimes and airplanes and cars and dogs. Oh, the hot air of the Black Rock Desert day does cool for a while to how it is tonight here, but usually in late summer on its way down to freezing, but here and there cross in many other subtler ways. Hope, too, is in the air here and there and many countless other places. Poison that is Donald Trump seems to be drying up, losing its sting, inviting more ridicule than fear day by day. U.S. Election Day is still 2 months off, but hope is a powerful thing to put down, to keep down. I endorse Kamala Harris and Tim Walz for the next president and vice president of the U.S. I feel they will bring back intelligence and empathy and decency and a basic respect for democracy so threatened these recent years. Two, I have hope that 2025 may bring, finally, the real vaccines needed for any human soul again to live safely in the world amongst his or her fellows. Patience can be a hard thing, but this situation insists on it. My companions in this lingering moment, the trees, the wind, even the dogs and the wind chimes, may seem indifferent to these human concerns I describe, yet they are affected by how well we do. We have more power to harm our shared world than they to prevent this. So we have to hope, find hope, make hope. We have to care when it's easy and when it's hard. There is ever a strength and a vulnerability in each of us and all around. And our choices matter, yours and mine. I hope you enjoy this issue, wherever and however it finds you. Notes from New England. Please accept this ragged purse of high notes. History of the No Borders Free Bookstore, 1999 to 2024. Introduction. 8/31/2024, 8:57 a.m., Bungalow C, Attic Study, Millcrest, Massachusetts. About noontime today, so an hour or so from now, my beloved Katie and I will carry an armful of chapbooks to our house's front lawn, specifically to a cypress green colored little free library, LFL, we purchased a few weeks ago, built by the Amish in Wisconsin, and shipped to us last week. We set it up last night. Little free libraries look like big mailboxes from a distance, like a box on a post, usually in front of someone's house or apartment. Closer up reveal inside shelves of books and perhaps some trinkets too. Usually bear the owner's name affixed on a metal nameplate and a sign that encourages one to take a book or leave a book. According to Wikipedia, there are over 150,000 of these free public book exchanges in 115 countries. The first one was built in 2009 by Todd Bowl in Hudson, Wisconsin, in the shape of a one-room schoolhouse as a tribute to his late mother, a school teacher who loved books. From that first LFL set up on his front lawn, he and his partner Rick Brooks helped to spread the LFL idea far and wide. Our LFL's nameplate reads, Little Free Library, No Borders Free Bookstore, scripturepress.com. As our current LFL version of No Borders Free Bookstore is relatively small, 18 by 22 by 14 and a quarter, we are only putting out a portion of our sum total of 78 Burning Man books, 22 Scripture Press samplers, and 9 Ray books. We'll rotate titles in and out, and no cynicals, too tall to fit. And here's where the current moment begins to connect back for me, more than 2 decades, to my first trip to the Burning Man Arts Festival, located in Black Rock City in Nevada's Black Rock Desert, in 1999, and to the first iteration of No Borders Free Bookstore I brought there with my friend Mio Cohn. Culled for my secret joy amongst these times, the history of Scripture Press, and other sources, as well as with this new introduction and conclusion, and containing photos not gathered for publication before, I will tell the story of No Borders Free Bookstore so far as it hits 25 years and counting. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 30th to September 6th, 1999. In August 1999, being jobless and on summer break from graduate school at Emerson College in Boston, I was able to devote my full time to Scripture Press's newest project, Burning Man Books. Working with my new friend Mio Cohn, we produced 5 chapbook titles intended for the Burning Man Arts Festival 1999 to be distributed there at our No Borders Barter Bookstore and More, as it was originally called. We traveled together a week in our car, the 3,000 miles from Boston to the festival's location, Black Rock City in Nevada's Black Rock Desert. We also brought several other new Scripture Press publications. Scripture Press Sampler 1999 number 1, my Ray Book number 1, Orpheus and Eurydice Making the Lyre, and Ray Book number 2, Ricamonte's Fairy Tales and Other Poems. The Ray Books were created by my dear artist friend, Barbara Brandon, and myself. Burning Man Books inaugurated a special project division of Scripture Press. Its 1999 volumes include Let the Beauty We Love Be What We Do, selections from the poems of Rumi, Are You Ready for Burning Man 1999, a coloring book, Beauty Crowds Me Till I Die, selections from the poems of Emily Dickinson, All Things Flow from the Holy Ghost, selections from the poems and prose of Rainer Maria Rilke, and Strawberry Fields Forever, a short anthology of writings about psychedelics. These books, save for the coloring book, which was for fun, contain vital art that has not often gotten into the hands of people who simply cannot afford to buy volumes of them in bookstores. The point of disseminating art has nothing to do with commercial gain. Artists wish to share their visions, their struggles, their joys, the ways they've found to make it in this world. Art brings edification and entertainment to the many people in great need of these. No profit has been or ever will be sought from these titles. A higher moral purpose is at stake, to make people happy, encourage them to keep trying, show them they are not alone with their struggles and woes, and that art is there to heal, and that there are people who want to make sure its healing powers are spread as far as and as wide as possible. We arrived at the festival and spent several days with many others helping our friend Chuck Nichols erect his Temple of the Eternal Mysteries totem. On 9/3/99 and 9/4/99, we set up our bookstore near Totem and bartered our books for seashells, necklaces, fire dancers, stories, smiles. It was fantastic. I also wrote poems for people on request because I think it's a shame so few people have poems written for them. Every person should have at least one. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 26th to September 4th, 2000. That summer, I spent working on contract at Harvard Business School Publishing, going off to dance at fish shows near and wide, and readying for my return to Burning Man. This time I traveled to it by plane. I determined to bring a No Borders Free bookstore again, now better named, and toward this end created a half dozen Burning Man books, 2,000 volumes. Henry David Thoreau's Excerpts from Walden, Ralph Waldo Emerson's The Transcendentalist, The Universe's Procession, Selected Poetry by Walt Whitman, Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Artist of the Beautiful, Allen Ginsberg Howell, and Eyes of the World, a second anthology writing about psychedelics. Sadly, the totem camp remained an unbuilt shambles this time due to uncooperative soil and poor planning. Having no set location to gift our books, a campmate of mine named Renee and I walked through the streets of Black Rock City, handing them out grab bag style. Burning Man 2000 was one full of personal strife for me and a frequent sense of isolation and loneliness. One night, very high on acid, I writhed in my tent, leaving it via a kind of out-of-body experience, rising, looking down at the great and tiny thing that was Black Rock City below, and was told somehow that I did not have to go back. Another chance to opt out of this plane, it being one of infinite numbers. I chose to remain for the time being, though I wondered what would have been discovered in my tent had I chosen to depart. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 27th to September 3rd, 2001. Unemployed again. Theme. And Burning Man preparation took the most of my energy, work, focus, and money anyway. I determined to go, and what money I didn't spend on rent and bills and long-distance phone cards to call to a girl named Lisa, who I liked very much then, I spent on readying for my third annual trip to Black Rock City. Burning Man Books 2001 features these volumes: Aldous Huxley's seminal essay on mescaline, Doors of Perception, T.S. Eliot's early important poem, Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, Rainer Maria Rilke's profoundly influential Letters to a Young Poet, J.D. Salinger's beautiful and cryptic fiction For Esme with Love and Squalor, Edgar Allan Poe's classic story, Fall of the House of Usher, Herman Melville's genius tale, Bartleby the Scrivener, and a third anthology of writing on psychedelics, Pantomime Mixtures of Heaven and Earth. 7 books in all, to bring the series to 18 total, and here on to publish 6 a year. More meaningful than this, however, was adding to the series works profoundly important to me. Rilke's letters showed me how to write, how to think. Salinger's story showed me the great raw potency of storytelling. Huxley's essay arches over societal prejudices about psychedelics, about the unlimited depths of the world and humanity itself, to reveal strange goodness and clutching beauty at the heart of creation. These 3 among a dear group of works were what I carried with me to the festival and its many highs and lows. The nights wandering the desert, ragged and high and weirdly happy. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 26th to September 2nd, 2002. Finally moved out west to stay with my Burning Man friend Sean Lamont in Seattle and to pursue romance with Lisa down in Portland, fruitlessly. When summer came, I got Scriptor Press back in gear and set to making new books for the fourth annual appearance of Norbotter's free bookstore at Burning Man. As I had before, I engaged my friend and collaborator Barbara Brandon to design and layout the books. I selected the authors and works and did the printing and binding work. Just as my dear friend and brother Jim Burke III taught me much of how to pursue artistic visions, and my dear friend and brother David Hartley taught me how to rent consensus realities, limiting perceptions, so too my dear friend and sister Brandon taught me countless things about how to craft beautiful vehicles to deliver these visions and perceptions. The Burning Man Books 2002 volumes include A Terrible Beauty is Born, Selected Poems of William Butler Yeats, The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, Digging to be Dug in Return, Selected Poems of Langston Hughes, Everything Carries Me to You, Selected Poems of Pablo Neruda, The World Will End in Fire, Selected Poems of Robert Frost, and I Am You and What I See Is Me, a fourth anthology of writings about psychedelics. Yeats' poetry sings and growls, reaches and reaches wildly far. Kafka's fiction elaborates the nightmarish diminishment of the individual in the modern world. Neruda's poetry has a rough, burning hide to it, affects deeply what it touches. Frost's poems are bony and plain, smart, lovely wastes. The anthology continued my work of getting out to the counterculture, words wise and pretty about the psychedelic outlands. The Hughes volume I included for Lisa, she called him a favorite poet. I made this volume for her from Diminishing Love's Best Impulse. He's a good poet, so no regrets. With fast-going money, I took the bookmasters Brandon sent and spent days at making them into chapbooks at a copier shop near the University of Washington. The Afghan family ran the place as friendly and took care of me and my project. At night, I returned to my friend's home and bound the chapbooks using a special stapler. I went to Burning Man 2002 with a desperate need for relief, for kindness, for rest, for clarity. I asked for everything. I was given much. It was a long week in the desert with my sadness and fear, knowing I had no money left, heartbroken, having to make it on my own out west soon or give up. No Borders Bookstore was its yearly success. I returned to Seattle, ready to renew my struggle. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 25th to September 1st, 2003. Slunk back east, empty as a pocket. That's a pulse on my mind. Staying in an extra bedroom in my dear friend G.C. Dillon's apartment. Fortune struck me when a resume sent to a local weekly newspaper yielded a hit. I was hired to copy edit the Hartford Advocate for 6 weeks, while its regular copy editor was on sick leave. I had not had a job I so liked in years. It was a pleasure to bust into Hartford several days a week and read copy. I could gladly have done this job for years. As it was, the experience helped me feel a renewed sense of good self and to save money to get west again. I could barely afford this fourth annual trip to Black Rock City and the cost of repairing my No Borders Free Bookstore, but I sunk all into it, hoping I could heal some chasms and figure out where next my path. And so another summer of making Burning Man books. I employed my new used copier to generate the pages, and my reliable old Macintosh did its part too. My friend Brandon helped me one last time to make the books good. There's no real explanation of what this project means to me, then and now, how removing my life for a week, a year, to a utopian community in the desert affects the rest of the year. I manifest truly there, and thus bear a model for the other 51 weeks. The Burning Man Books 2003 volumes feature Virginia Woolf's Death of Poetry, the text of a letter to a young poet friend of hers, a hopeful, funny missive shot through with despairing prose, F. Scott Fitzgerald's lovely elegiac, Babylon Revisited, clean, prosy music lifted high on humility gained and love realized. Dylan Thomas's In My Art or Soul and Craft, a collection of his rowdy mystic poems, Anger and Want, elegantly bald. Ernest Hemingway's A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, a very short but striking fiction, one I first read when I was 18 in a book on existentialism that I found in the $3 for $1 bins in front of a long-gone Hunting News bookstore in Hartford, Connecticut. Can You Pass the Acid Test, a fourth anthology of writings about psychedelics, contents including, among others, writings by William James, Houston Smith, Jay Stevens, and Alan Watts, and the first non-textbook since 1999's coloring book, Build This Book, a Burning Man Blank Book. Decorated with quotes from previous Burning Man titles, it seemed inevitable that an event devoted to self-expression would find a pile of blank books gifted in its midst. It was a good bunch of titles, and I also brought Scriptor Press Sampler 2, 2000 annual, long delayed. It featured writings by Sular, Chacon, Amante, Charette, Dylan, and a cover by Brandon, How Come and Gone. Burning Man's Arts Festival, August 30th to September 6, 2004. Back in Seattle for the long run this time, now with KD, and she became the third collaborator I worked with on the Burning Man book series. Miyoko in 99, Solo 2000, Barbara Brand in 2001 to 2003, and gave the project exciting new impulse. We worked especially closely on volumes by Octavio Paz and Basho. The Burning Man books 2004 volumes include Flannery O'Connor's Savage Tale, A Good Man is Hard to Find. O'Connor is a favorite writer I share with Brannon. Her fiction is merciless and is drilling in for the subtle, hard morality of a situation or truth. Truth as she knows it wins. Angels and devils both live and die according to this truth. Carl Gustav Jung's essay on the nature of dreams is an old favorite of mine, and one whose ideas color my own in thinking about the collective unconscious. I do pursue their sometimes insightful, even prophetic qualities a bit further than he does. Octavio Paz's long poem, Sunstone, conjures sweet recollection of its being chosen for our series. I knew I wanted something by the Mexican master, but not sure what. Katie and I went to the Elie Bay bookstore one day and sat with a volume of collected poems. Perhaps on a whim, she began reading this 600-plus-line poem and didn't stop till its end. The selection was made. Later, she read it to me again, its crazy swoops of meaning and melody, as I typed it on my Macintosh. James Joyce's short story, The Dead, was another old friend culled from his collection Dubliners, which I first read many years ago in grad school. I'm also a fan of John Huston's 1987 film version. A quite visceral tale of love and regret, it sounds its highest note in conclusion. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead. That's Joyce. He takes some prisoners, especially Dubliners. The sixth annual volume of psychedelic anthologies is called Stones of Your Mind, a line nipped from John Lennon's brilliant song Mind Games. Its featured authors include Theodore Golis, The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment, Robert Hunter, The Withering Way of the Revolution, Ralph Metzner's Seven Phases of Sociocultural Transformation Catalyzed by LSD and Psychedelics, Alexander Shulgin, The Agony and Ecstasy of Alexander Shulgin, and Jerry Graham, Same Time. And the last of the half dozen new titles, Basho's Songs of Cherry Blossoms Falling, is, like the Paz book, especially dear to me. It began as an anthology of haiku, meant to cover a wide space of centuries, but the scope narrowed as time went on. Anthologies to be successful must be sharp in focus, summed in a short phrase. Katie and I looked at many books of haiku, evolved from the haiku no renga, and eventually chose the progenitor of the form, the 17th century poet Basho. We read through many, many of Basho's poems to choose 36, and thus create the best of the best of his work. Poems like Midfield, Attached to Nothing, The Skylark Singing, and You Turn This Way, I'm Also Lonely, This Autumn Evening, and The Whole Household, Each with White Hair and Cane, Visiting a Grave. At one point, we sat together in the Seattle Public Library and read a children's storybook detailing Basho's wander across Japan. I think indie presses like ours are built soul up to receive such blessed hours. Katie and I brought Scriptor Press's many books and publications, 24 copies of over 40 titles each day, to Black Rock City's Center Camp, spread them all on a blanket, and mixed in with the crowds going by, stopping to see. This was No Borders Free Bookstore's sixth year and my favorite so far. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 28th to September 4th, 2005. The summer proved an especially busy one for publishing-related events. We attended an event called Stetset, a gathering of local Indian zine publishers at a local Seattle bar and cafe downtown. It was fun for Katie and I to see our local peers. We also attended the Portland Zine Symposium, a larger event in downtown Portland. To the first event, we stayed up all night, readying copies of Cynical 54 to bring. To the latter, we brought Cynical's, Scriptor Press Samplers, Ray Books, and Burning Man Books, a whole array of projects to gift away. These events were new to us, a way to expand where our work touched and whom we met. Our trip in August to Burning Man 2005 was, of course, the summer's highlight and what our work finally pointed toward. We drove this year our Crimson 2000 Pontiac Grand Prix SE, Sydney. Sydney, our bikes hanging from her trunk, our week's worth of water, supplies, tents, and crates of chapbooks. No Borders Free Bookstore opened for business at Black Rock City for a seventh year. What made the trip more poignant and precious was the money difficulties we faced that August. My editing job in an online travel agency ended suddenly. Panic at the time. Looking back, good riddance. Scrambling for new work while reading hundreds of chapbooks made for tense days. it worked out. I scored work and even was able to have time off from the new job to travel to Burning Man. I was happy it played out as it did. What mattered bluntly were the paychecks clearing and our freedom to leave Seattle for a week for our other home. The volumes in Burning Man Books 2005 are Herman Hesse's lyrical Strange News from Another Planet, William Faulkner's horrific Dry September, Jorge Luis Borges's cryptic Circular Ruins, Philip K. Dick's sweet The King of the Elves, All His Dream, a seventh volume of Writings on Psychedelics, and dear to me, especially for the work Katie and I did on it together, Many Blooms, an anthology of modern women poets. Many Blooms is conceived by Katie, who wanted to make a volume devoted to women poets. We tried out various ideas, asking ourselves what range of times and places could we fit in a 40 to 60 page chapbook. After reading widely and thinking out loud to each other many times, we chose six American and European poets: Wisława Szymborska, Elizabeth Bishop, Joy Graham, Adrienne Rich, Marianne Moore, and Margaret Atwood. This book works because its focus is whittled sharply enough and its contents are chosen carefully enough to create a coherent whole. The selection process for Burning Man Books has become more complex as the library of titles has grown. For the first several years, I simply selected my favorite writers. More recently, I began to seek a balance, a range, more female writers, more non-Western writers, and more pre-modern writers. Slowly, this plan has been working while the literary quality of the library has grown from its variety. The short fictions in 2005 brought several major voices into the collection: Faulkner, Hess, Borges, and unhooked from his genre grotto, the great Philip K. Dick. All His Dream, the newest psychedelics anthology, continues Scripter Press's open mission to educate the counterculture old and young, and anyone else willing to read, about the profound and continuing effects of psychedelics on human development. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 28th to September 4th, 2006. July and August, Katie and I spent preparation for bringing Scripter Press projects to the Portland Zine Symposium and then to Burning Man 2006. This was the second year we brought books to both events. The volumes of Burning Man Books 2006 include The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus, a brief potent essay I'd read as a youth in a volume of existentialist writings; A Time to Break Silence, selected works of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., which includes Letter from Birmingham Jail, I Have a Dream, and Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence; All Paths Lead Where, selected poetry and artwork of E.E. Cummings; A Small Good Thing by Raymond Carver; Carson McCullers, A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud; and We Have Drunk the Soma, an eighth anthology of writings about psychedelics, which includes How Psychedelics Informed My Life and Sex Work by Annie Sprinkle; The Long Strange Trip Continues by Jim De Rogatis; The Mysteries of Eleusis by Albert Hoffman; The Electric Kool-Aid Medicine Test by Terrence McNally; and Number 15, Broderick Street. What is especially contrasting about the two events, Beyond the Zine Fest's sedate Portland State University ballroom setting versus Burning Man's somewhat brutal, dusty desert city, is that No Borders Free Bookstore, Scripter Press's bookstore for Burning Man Books, Cynicals, Samplers, and Ray Books, is a bit more in its native element amidst the semi-anarchy of Black Rock City and its gift economy than the room full of zinesters and freaks in downtown Portland. Yet both matter very much. Both events were successfully attended. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 27th to September 3rd, 2007. While preparing to move in mid-September from Seattle down to Portland, where I actually had a job waiting, Katie and I worked on preparation for Scripter Press's third appearance at the Portland Scene Symposium and ninth appearance at the Burning Man Arts Festival. Core to this presentation was adding six new titles to the Burning Man book series. Sometimes I've chosen to include writers that I would argue should be considered as among the best of the best, while others would disagree. On the other hand, some of the greats, such as William Blake and D.H. Lawrence, may never be represented. It comes down to a few criteria. Do I like the writer very much? Can his or her work be enjoyed without a presumed knowledge of many other books? Can his or her work be fairly represented in a 40 to 60 page chapbook? The last few years, the selection process has become more a collaboration between Katie and me, and I've had to do more research to find new additions to the series. I've usually begun the work in January, and Katie would join me not long after. Burning Man Books 2007's picks include Joyce Carol Oates' fiction The Witness, a story selected after reading dozens of her short fictions; Joseph Campbell's mythology essay Bios and Mythos includes a glossary for some of its more challenging diction and terms; Plato's The Myth of the Cave is a work I read long ago in a philosophy class and decided it would aid the series in touching on classical philosophy; Sherwood Anderson's selections from Winesburg, Ohio is another favorite, despite my belief that I have no old favorites left to publish. Its challenge was to call a chapbook of pieces from a story sequence too long to publish as a whole; If There Is No God, selected poetry and prose of Cheslin Malouche, a book Katie and I worked pretty hard to create, Maloche, an amazing and prolific writer, was new to both of us. Infinite Coincidence, a ninth anthology writing about psychedelic, is titled from a song by the indie rock band Bright Eyes. This volume includes a chemistry discussion of psychedelics by Rick Straussman, a vintage 1966 essay on LSD from the underground journal Ramparts, an essay about the Eleusinian Mysteries by Carl A.P. Ruck, a 1983 interview with the scientist John Lilly, a 2006 press piece about ending the taboo on psychedelic psychotherapy, and a list of recommended psychedelic websites. The Portland Zine Symposium went well for us, although the basic presumption there was that the wares are sold or traded. Some people shied away from our free bookstore. Others, however, were very enthused, and so made the experience worthwhile. Burning Man 2007 was this wonderful, overwhelming experience. We not only brought Senecal, Samplers, Ray books, and Burning Man books, new and old, but we proofread every Burning Man book to fix old errors. It took weeks. But why bring over 1,000 books to such an event if they are not close to error-free? Burning Man Arts Festival, August 5th to September 1st, 2008. This is the 10th year I've assembled the No Borders Free Bookstore, 5th year with KD. Burning Man Books 2008 volumes include Rachel Carson's environmental essay, Mother Sea, The Great Beginnings, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's short fiction anthology, Fugitives, Survivors of a Celestial Conspiracy, W.S. Merwin's selection of poetry, Walking at Night, Between the Two Deserts, Singing, Fyodor Dostoevsky's short fiction, The Dream of a Ridiculous Man, Out Here We Have Stoned Immaculate, a 10th anthology of writings about psychedelics, and Hakim Bey's underground socio-political classic, Taz, The Temporary Autonomous Zone. The festival itself was fun as always, though again, I was attending unemployed. But 10 years of living out the year and then making it to Black Rock City was a reward in itself, biking the desert deep into the night, handing out hundreds of chapbooks that would travel around the world. Katie and I worked hard to get there and make the week a good one. Driving in Sydney from western Oregon to northern Nevada, we had many a good adventure away from Portland, a forested area of central and southern Oregon called the Oregon Outback Scenic Byway marks for me a waking life counterpart to my fiction's White Woods. We also brought No Borders Free Bookstore to the Portland Zine Symposium, third year in a row, first time while living there. It's a great event, but in truth, Scripter Press did not quite fit in there. Not sure why. Different kinds of weird, maybe. Burning Man Arts Festival, August 31st to September 7th, 2009. So once more, I began my preparations for us to bring No Borders Free Bookstore to the Desert Fest. But in 1999, the process had been so much simpler. For one thing, that first time picking the titles meant choosing among the many, many writers I admired. By 2009, I'd gone through 50 of my favorites. How many does any one person have? As the years had gone on, I more and more had to seek out new writers, experiment, test, or dredge up writers I recalled reading years ago and see what I thought of them now. It was a subtle process in that I had to police myself with the following test. Can I talk up this writer's work with the greatest, most unalloyed enthusiasm? If I didn't believe totally in the little books we sat in the desert under a big tent handing out to hundreds of strangers, what was I doing then? This exploration, I can see more clearly now, took its toll. My reading habits began to revolve more and more around which writers might provide good material for chapbooks. This bothered me some, even as it was a challenge I rose to for a number of years running. I determined to make each year's half dozen new books as fine a crop as those of the previous years. It mattered as much in 2009 as it had every year running back to 1999. As I contemplate the next new book series in the Burning Man books mode, my thoughts remain the same. Do it fucking right, no question. There was a shifting external context to the preparation of those last half dozen books, and the printing of the whole series, plus the Ray books, the samplers, and the recent Senecals. My new job in downtown Portland was by no means a sure and long-term situation. It hardly seemed it would last the 6 months offered in contract, and the Portland job market was awful for new prospects. So we thought of Burning Man 2009 in part as a chance to talk to a lot of San Francisco area residents about life further down the coast, what we might find there. And unusually, work on the next issue of the Senecal drifted into July. Plus, I was producing my radio show, Within's Within, Scenes from the Psychedelic Revolution, every weekend, as well as helping get about a dozen other shows broadcast on Spirit Plants Radio, which we had taken over running in 2008. And I was writing my various works, Labyrinthine, Mini Musics, Bags and News, as often as possible. In sum, it was a lot to be doing. Yet I'm still proud to say that the 2009 Burning Man books produced were worth the efforts of many nights' work. These volumes are Slouching Toward Bethlehem by Joan Didion, The Secret Sharer by Joseph Conrad, Silent Snow, Secret Snow by Conrad Aiken, The Story of Sinbad the Sailor from the Arabian Nights, Fate Isn't What We're Up Against, an 11th anthology writing about psychedelics, and The Long, Perfect Loveliness of Sal. Selected Poetry of Galway Canal. There are some strange crossovers and themes among these titles. Sinbad and Secret Sharer are both about ocean voyages and bear mysterious atmospheres. Silent Snow is all mysterious atmosphere and ends so terrifyingly that it stayed solid in my memory since I read it a quarter century before. Didion's essay was Kate East's pick, and I can't help but think that its portrait of Haight-Ashbury, San Francisco fit well with the San Francisco-created Burning Man Festival of four decades later. I was led to Galway Canal's poetry in part by studying and featuring the work of his friend W.S. Merwin in Burning Man Books 2008. Finally, the 11th psychedelic anthology pleases me in several ways, from its cover portrait of a broken steps leading to a tree to be found in a park in Portland, not far from where we lived, to its continuing our mission to educate people about the promise, possibilities, and seriousness of psychedelic materials. So we packed up Sydney and drove our days and miles from Portland to Black Rock City, Nevada, put up our tent, set up No Borders Free Bookstore for four long, hot, worthwhile days of gifting out chapbooks, wandered the strange city at night, made friends for a moment, an hour, a few days, set me out on a couple of long solo bike rides into the night while Katie rested from the day's heat, enjoyed one more time the spectacular burning of the man come Saturday, packed up on Sunday, and returned with a bit of meander in Oregon through Bend to Portland. First hiatus, 2010 to 2015. It began with a lack of enthusiasm in December 2009 to begin the prep work, gathering material for No Borders Free Bookstore. Simply put, I discovered that I didn't want to. I had never not wanted to before. I didn't know what this meant. Further mixed into it was further discussing with Katie leaving Portland and where to next. Seemed most likely San Francisco or Boston. The former didn't really interest me as it once had. Perhaps if I knew people and jobs were easy to come by, or if I had arrived with one, like had been true with Portland 2007. In 2010, we moved to Boston, which I left for the West Coast, to be nearer to Burning Man in part, back in 2002. I did some research on what could next be a good new host for No Borders Free Bookstore, but no easy luck. I worked grindingly slow for years on the next half dozen new Burning Man books. For example, by 2013, I was reading through the novels and poetry of Richard Brautigan toward his entry in the series, when the series continued. I just didn't know how hard it would be to find a successor, but finding Burning Man itself online back in 1998 had been a fluke in itself. For a while, I played with the idea of renaming the series TransArt Books, TAB, and working toward a 2012 launch. No go. Still, simply put, the No Borders Free Bookstore idea never left me, never lost its lure and charm in my mind and heart. Then, in early 2014, I did some looking into a Burning Man regional event called Firefly, held annually since 2003, around July 4th, up in the Vermont woods. I emailed with lots of people on the Firefly emailing list, liked their vibe, and decided it was time to actively rejoin the Burning Man world, and do it this time at the event in the Vermont woods. I was hopeful that this change of locale would be a good one. Dust off my old camping skills, but also learn about the challenges of an environment very different from the Black Rock Desert, something both familiar and novel in this new experience. I also liked the Firefly as a regional event, and so the chance to involve in its community year-round was another lure. I applied for a 2015 creativity grant for No Borders Bookstore, intending this to be the year I went, but then decided not to go. I wasn't ready. Firefly, June 29th to July 4th, 2016. It's about 3 hours from where Katie and I live up to Bethel, Vermont, to the Lurland Retreat, whose lands the Firefly Festival is held on every summer. Closer than any previous instance I'd had of getting from wherever home was at the time to the burn. But this was not Black Rock City in the Black Rock Desert. These are Vermont woods, where many years ago I danced and died on a lot of acid one beautiful night at the Bread and Puppet Festival in Gulliver, Vermont, about 2 hours north of Bethel. Maybe that cherished memory led me curiously back up there. I just wanted to resume, and I was ready. By April, I was busy printing 2016 Burning Man books. Katie helped me every step of the way, but did not come this time. Traveling by bus, my load was slimmed down to a big hiking bag, tents, tent chair, and three crates of chapbooks. Plenty of anti-tick wipes in my gear, too, for the hot Vermont woods. I joined up with a camp called the Steam Bath Project, who let me be part of their traveling crew and pay my membership fee for water and food they hauled up. My bookstore was not directly relevant to what they were doing, but they provided me with a big shade tent and tables to set up No Borders Free Bookstore on a lovely hill overlooking the many activities below. Kind folks. In addition to Cenacles, Ray Books, and Scriptor Press samplers, the 2016 Burning Man Books volumes I brought were Violence and Human Nature by Howard Zinn, a well-known American intellectual and writer, long a favorite of KD's. This piece has these wonderful lines. It is true that there is an infinite human capacity for violence. There is also an infinite potential for kindness. The unique ability of humans to imagine gives enormous power to idealism and imagining of a better state of things not yet in existence. Entering Dreamland, a brief anthology of writings about dreams, is a volume that has just stayed in my mind a long time. I wish to focus more attention to both the value and mysteries of dreaming. It includes fiction as well as various kinds of nonfiction pieces. The Book of Pooh by A.A. Milne, with decorations by Ernest H. Shepherd, of course. These were excerpts from another author whose imaginative world is writ deep through my own. Like Home Cooking, Selected Short Fictions of Richard Brautigan, one of whose last books I had found in a bargain bin when I was a youth. I seem to find books in bargain bins. This time I read his books from start to finish, and a fat biography to boot, labor of love to decide which pieces to include here. The End of Artist piece by Seamus Heaney, a brilliant Irish poet, favorite of many of my writer friends, and a lovely pleasure to spend hours among his words. And Singing Our Way Through the Wilderness, a 12th anthology writing about psychedelics, and the happy delight of continuing the series within series of volumes. Led it off with Dr. Timothy Leary, a man I profoundly esteem. Good contents throughout. It had taken 7 years to get to this point of return, living in a home Katie and I had bought, live in now, working for a better employer than I had versus most of the jobs I'd held, and having chosen a local version of the big event to ease back in. The long-time planning and preparation was pretty damn good. I was as ready as I could be. But, in the course of stapling the mini chapbooks, which I'd done thousands of times before, this time, sitting at this self-same driftwood table, I stapled wrong somehow. It's a physical act, but not one I'd ever been hurt by before. Nonetheless, even before I was packed up to go, I suffered a strained right quad muscle. That's a muscle located in one's upper thigh. It's the kind of injury athletes will suffer in practice or in games. They know enough to stretch their bodies before and after play. Did not know this. I was going to go if I had to drag myself there. So I went. Taxi with gear to the Firefly bus, running from Boston up to Vermont. Limped me and my bags to the place where the Steam Bath Project was camped. Set up my tent, very hilly place. Eventually set up No Borders bookstore. Tried to smile and be friendly to all I met. Fuck, did I hurt. And it kept me from enjoying this event as much as I might have. Firefly gets 1,000 people or so coming each year versus Burning Man's 60,000 or more these days. But walking was a pain, sleeping was a torture. I worried the tick season I'd come to, despite the meds I'd brought. I made a friend who sat with me for many hours, gifting out books. I journeyed into the nights as best I could. I tried to grok all that I was able. It was the best return I could muster for No Borders Free Bookstore, and yet the injury, needless if I was ignorant of physical health, better in the intervening years, in part because of this event, I would have enjoyed it more. Limped and hauled my stuff back to the bus to Boston, thanked everyone I could for letting me join in, wishing I could have done more. And that, again, was that, for a number of years. Ultimately, I decided I had to get back to Burning Man at Black Rock City in the Black Rock Desert. Second hiatus, 2017 to 2023. So I'd managed to successfully pull off another iteration of No Borders Free Bookstore and learned that I can do it outside of Black Rock City if needed, and yet I prefer not to. This learning has stuck with me since in my decision-making process. Another Firefly trip was out. Too small, too many ticks. Not the desert. Not Burning Man, though not also. A personal way of thinking, no more. I was slow to get to the next step. That great job went downhill and I was laid off in 2019. Burning Man is far and it costs a lot of money to attend, especially in recent years. I had to have good work to afford it, additional to helping finance our usual quality of living. But then two things hit that totally clashed. First, the global COVID-19 pandemic into March 2020 shut the world down and changed it forever. No matter the cultural amnesia or just plain lazy stupidity of most, nothing has ever returned to like it was before then. Second, because of the pandemic, in the fall of 2020, I lucked into a good contract working for a synthetic biology company in Boston, one helping with the COVID-19 virus testing. Worked hard and got to be full-time there after a year or so. Good money, enough to afford the more expensive trip to Burning Man. But Burning Man didn't occur in 2020 or 2021. Too dangerous to pull it off. So I had the bread, but no event to go to. 2022 came, and this time I meant it. But the event had become weird. In new ways, hard to deal with. Expense, yes. But also tickets selling out, bureaucratic nightmares to sort through, and how to get there. Driving was not going to work, and I tried to get into a camp, but found that maybe I had lost my chops on how to do this even, so I didn't go. Then that good job went bad too, and 2023 was too awful for me to do anything about any of this, only just to keep along and keep dreaming. laid off in August 2023, thinking Burning Man 2024. Burning Man Arts Festival by way of Little Free Library, August 25th to September 2nd, 2024. I so wanted to go to Burning Man 2024 this year. I so wish I was there right now, this moment, in that hot desert, little sleep to my name for days, waking up in a dusty sleeping bag, spent, thirsty, exhausted, and exhilarated. But the world prevented this. Its iniquitous handling of the global pandemic these last several years. Sickness and death on a daily basis for thousands that did not have to occur if it wasn't generally decided that convenience and economics matter more than human life. Nobody can ever tell me that what has been happening and is happening now is not a collective crime against humanity that nobody is innocent of committing. Even those of us who are sheltering in place, we are intent to survive to better vaccines, unnameable hopeful days to come. But could we be doing better? Yes. Humanity is guilty. No devil or space alien or monster from the depths to blame. We did this to ourselves. It continues to happen. That said, I did not go in person again this year, but it was months ago that I began to think of different ways to go that were safe, given how the world is now. And I looked into a few options. Someone was planning a virtual reality burn. Or maybe I could find kind souls to carry Burning Man books to the festival, to burn night, gift a few along the way, and toss the rest into the fires. Nice ideas, yet I did not pursue them hard. They remained in my back pocket. But for this year, I needed something that did not primarily involve others than Katie and me. So I began to think more and more about the Little Free Library idea. We have a nice front lawn. I mow it most Sundays, from spring to autumn. In our back when Burning Man days, we lived in apartments. So, if you purchased one of these LFLs, what would go into it? What did it mean to do this? Was this like Firefly trying to find some other way to going to Burning Man without going to Black Rock City? Some easier route if it worked? No. What it means for me is that I'm acknowledging both that I want to go back, and yet this year I cannot safely go back. The travel to get there, that would be hard enough, but doable with heavy masking. But then, once there, not to be able to safely share air with my fellow burners? How would I be part of something I'm terrified of? How is that a return? Hand out chapbooks with a smile under my mask? No. This LFL idea is a way of going from here. And it hurts me to do so. But not going at all, yet again, hurts me more. So we picked out a nice LFL, placed our order, and once again got ready to host No Borders Free Bookstore at Burning Man 2024. From here. And then was decided I wanted to up the game. Bring new issues of everything, Scripture Press New England publishes. 2024 Burning Man books, six of them, of course. Scripture Press Sampler 22, 2020 Annual, catching that series up. A new Ray book, first in 9 years. And Seneca 125, Summer 2024, a skinny issue for the short timetable to create it. No fooling and no shit. This was no retreat of an idea. This was me pushing the line hard. Of all these, the Ray book was most surprising. The idea had emerged from several that didn't yet, was to make my third book in the Ray book series, Dream Wraps Volumes 1 to 6. Wildly unexpected, but yes, it's done. It's out there in the No Borders Free Bookstore in that LFL on our front lawn. Katie and I created the new Burning Man books together, like we have for 20 years now. The authors chosen ended up being all mine this time, but the book covers and interior designs were all done by her brilliant self. The 2024 Burning Man books volumes include Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles came about because back in 1986, I was given a small check and a volume of Doyle's as an honorarium for being named Graduating English Major of the Year at my old college, Central Connecticut State University. Cashed the check, but then carried around with me this volume all these years, till the pandemic found me with more time to read and wish to read. Glad I did. Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism, like the piece in the Hemingway volume from Burning Man Books 2003, was one I first read in one of these Spanos as a casebook on existentialism. Had long ago lost my copy. Lucky Amazon.com had a copy. George MacDonald's The Golden Key is part of MacDonald's amazing body of fantasy writing that I only just discovered during the pandemic. This story is everything a fantasy story can be at its best. So happy to publish it. Malcolm X's His Final Vision was his last public speech given at Ford Auditorium, Detroit, Michigan, on February 14, 1965. A week later, he was gunned down. I've admired Malcolm X's philosophical evolution from the time I saw Spike Lee's amazing 1992 biographical film about him, starring the brilliant Denzel Washington. Anton Chekhov's Ward No. 6 came into the series late because other possibilities were not working. I'd had this piece in my Burning Man Books notes since 2009 or so, but though I had read and admired his work back in graduate school, I had not read this story. I don't know why it became the one in my notes. I sat down earlier this month, read it, enthralled, and that was that. Many Worlds, Many Doors, 13th Anthology of Psychedelic Writings. One, I wanted to reflect the best of what I've been reading since 2016. I think it does. Conclusion. 9-1-2024, 4 p.m. Bungalow C, Driftwood Table, Milkers, Massachusetts. We didn't get the No Borders Little Free Library up till early yesterday afternoon. So, noontime, by the way, time works in Black Rock City. And then the work to complete the Cynical did not finish yesterday as I wished to be followed in the evening by the Jellicoe Literary Guild, and along the way, a burn pit hour or two in the backyard, live streaming the night of the burn in Black Rock City along the way. That was the plan, but no. This is all finishing up a day later tonight. This piece and the yet unwritten Flum Schuller's notebooks will wrap it up, then the JG, fire pit, burn on live stream or recording. Things take as long as they do to finish up and become ready. I believe that going the weird route I've gone, and to be still caring so deeply about all of this, says plainly to me that there is more than old sentiment that causes me still to be wearing a Burning Man 2003 pendant on my neck. The challenging thing in life is to discover ways to keep what is important close, be it persons, art, events, dwellings, ideas, and so on. Life challenges us to care and continue to care through moments of suffering and celebration both, and the many dull ones too, to keep caring. By caring, we retain the better and some of the best of who we are over the long times and travels of a life. Writing this piece has been cathartic for me in that I've never told this story in this detail before. It has always been one stream of many. Now, having given it its deserved attention, I happily realize that I will get back to Black Rock City when it's safe to do so, and that some of it is here with me right now, every day, and that some of me is there right now, having never left. So, our friend Judy Weinstein-Hagai passed on October 7, 2023, on the first day of the Israel-Hamas conflict. She and her husband, Gad, passed on that day, though they've never been recovered, their bodies. She lived for many, 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 many years as a wonderful human being on this planet, a person of peace and art and love and fraternity to all. And she often went on retreats. She liked to go on retreats for her mental health, to get away from teaching, to get away from the stresses of living on the Israel-Gaza border, and many other things that anybody would have stresses and strains over. And so, as her friend and her editor, I have been bringing into the Cynical's pages poetry that she published at the Electro Lunch Forums that has never been in the Cynical before. And so I came upon, in my trawlings, Haiku While on Retreat, March 2023, which was would have been 6 months before she died.
Well, day one, return to myself, feelings re-blossoming, butterfly takes flight. Alas, guava tree, fruit so slow to ripen, yet three gifts today. Hello, lower back, surprisingly sensitive, paying attention. Day two. Early walk, lone soul with dog, two wayward jackals. Along kibbutz fence, jackal tunnel still blocked, sly secret roots. For a moment, shoulders relaxed in pure enjoyment. Day three. Thich Nhat Hanh, world filled with happiness, help yourself. Even in laziness, I go and discover so much to admire. Many thoughts, rowdy and impatient, calm down as I walk. You're good. Even unpublished. You are finding gems.
There's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was always, I was plucking a small handful of jewels from many.
Yep.
So Tamara Miles is our friend who lives down in South Carolina. She is a teacher, a musician, an artist. I think she's president of the South Carolina Poetry Society. Litany. Tomato seed, apostle whom the earth loved most. Mustard seed, for all the faith we need to move mountains. Apple, who tricked us and got our names on the board. Aloe, the balm of Gilead, for all the hopes we had. Blueberry, a memory of ancient verse and creed. Cinnamon and cardamom, the scents and flavors of the Bhagavad Gita. I am the taste and water, O son of Kunti, and the radiance of the sun and the moon. I am the sacred syllable, Om, in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound in ether. Carrot, to help the blind lead the blind. Dandelion escaped by the prophet Daniel just in time when he dreamed that he was both lion and den and interpreted that to mean he was alive. Daisy, counter of blessings, and he loves me. Never, though, he loves me not, for he that is without love is a clanging cymbal. Elephant ear, who fell from too much pride, let this be a warning, brethren. Eucalyptus, for when we are inflamed. Spinach, a favorite of Samson and all strong men, but not Delilah. The Philistines be upon thee, the Philistines be upon thee. Sassafras, to get to the root of it all. Mint, to sweeten the breath of the gods before they kiss us deeply. And do not apologize for it, because they know the rules of poetry as laid down by Burns. The honest and beautiful and truthful first object of poetry is a longing for sex. Gardenia, the most fragrant chapter at the southern end of all our troubles. Hosta, whose name is everlasting, and Heather for abundant love. Iris for all the mothers who we grieve in white, blue, and purple. Jonquil, lover herself who drowned from looking in too deeply too soon. Lantana, who can take the heat from 40 days and nights in the desert before we come to the promised land. Lemon, for keeping our hands clean and therefore holy, but only after digging in the earth. Milkweed, to bring butterflies in appreciation for small wing graces. Nettle, because it stings and awakens us again to necessary pain. Pansy, for diversity. Rosemary, for Ophelia and all those suffering from romance and death wishes, to help them remember the going under, the sweet drowning. Rose, thorn beauty, because we keep touching anyway, though we come away bleeding, because the scent of love is powerful, it lingers. Queen Anne's lace, a veil, for being loved like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Sage, for the wisdom of Solomon, who remembered his first love and built temples in her honor. Verbena, for sleeping with the sainted poets and angels, and after our loving, sleeping sweetly and soundly, but not without dreams. Willow, for those who weep and are comforted, now or in a coming age. Yarrow, lover of bleeding heart liberals, and once again, the poets who will never stop the flow of blood or tears until the revelation.
Good.
All right, so Jimmy Heffernan is our friend who lives in Sandy, Utah. He's a publisher of poetry and of volumes of thinking, science, philosophy, all sorts of things. So he recently wrote, earlier this year, I think, a book of poetry called Multiverse, a Book of Poems, published in January 2024 by Book Baby. And last issue and this one, I've excerpted a couple of poems of his, and Cassie will read them.
I don't think I can read as well as he does. I will try.
That's okay, do your best.
Socratic ontology. Among other ideas, Socrates was interested in how human ontology unfolds across life. He believed that we are born with all the knowledge we will ever have or need, and that over the course of our lives, knowledge is unlocked and unfolds, revealing to us what was inside all the time. In other words, as we age, we increasingly discover what we already really know, but didn't know we knew. So as we get older, we don't gain new information so much as our perspective widens, and we see the truth in new lights. As I get older, all this makes more and more sense. As life unfolds, the focus sharpens. Omega, a tractor at the end of time, portal to the bright divine. History is getting old, even for the free and bold. See it with a psychedelic, an ages-old future relic, the nature of the borderline, radical or taking time, a switch to flip for extinction, or rather vivid distinction. The future, then, is as the past occurs, then at the last. Our views of time, therefore, askew, delusions coming by the slew. Omega comes with all the tests. Pray we meet it with finesse. That was good.
Sam is our friend who lives in rural France. He is a stone-cold brilliant genius. He's very funny. He's a dear fellow. He's strange in endearing ways. But he's very, very, very kind. He's very kind. He's a decent human being. I think beyond all of his brilliant artistic traits and abilities, he's a decent human being. Writer's notebook, : the idea of finding reasons for why I'm irritable pops up, but that is just another thing to be irritated with. While outside, beauty lives. A light mist waits upon the earth. The rising sun agrees with the soft white orange of the rose. The church bells ring, sounding an among so inclusive that religions may continue to hope. I myself am not so gracious. I wish about half of everything would just shut up. I had some thought about how I feel, a thought that told me I was irritated. But when I felt about it, when I asked myself what I really felt, it was something more like the same, peaceful like that. I feel the way that does not change. But then something happens. I have to move for some reason, and the movement is irritable. So perhaps the thought is right. I'm sorry if the tense is muddled. Let me keep it all present for simplicity. I think of saying, then wonder if it isn't rather how it is, but then why should I want to keep it that way? Need to keep it that way. I'm definitely irritable. I want to say it is superficial compared to the deep feeling of not feeling that I'm no longer sure that I can feel. I want to act from that deeper place, but it doesn't seem to act. The idea of finding reasons for why I'm irritable pops up, just another thing to be irritated with. It is beautiful outside. There is a light mist clinging to the earth. I'm not happy with that word, clinging. I was going to say something about it being heavy, but that seemed wrong. I just wanted to say about the way it is low, as if emanating from the grass. That combined with the early light on the soft white orange of the rose. That is beautiful. The church bells begin to ring, also beautiful. A horse clamors unbeautifully with a bucket in a wheelbarrow, and my wife rustles something irritating on the table behind me. Is it irritating to have absolutely no control over what enters my airspace? I wonder if I have an outside. There is an inside this house and an outside, and it feels different outside. I feel different outside. I do wish about half of everything would just shut up. I see someone who feels like I do about feeling, and it's being a good word because it is a good thing. Let's say, feel more and think less, something stupid like that. I think that thing I said, if spirit, wind, breath shattered into, split into metaphorical and literal words, where once the word was one, and thus was the thought and the feeling, such that you wouldn't be able to breathe without breathing spirit, without feeling it a wind, same wind that made the beginning by blowing over the waters. Maybe feeling is going back the way that word came, but then what would feeling be literally, and what is feeling metaphorically speaking? Just emotion and sensation, isn't it? What are we talking about? What am I talking about? It all sounds better now. There are no irritating noises. The sound of an aeroplane begins to grow, but pleasantly so, the way it wavers, the way it makes the sky seem something of a cave, or rather shows this to be the case. The cows have wandered off. Is that a kind of past tense in the present? Do you know what it is like to be surrounded by moos? As if the earth itself has drug itself up into lumps, into lumbering. Around the stillness of your center, which is you as a pin in a map, there's also a pin through the dried butterfly of yourself. Around the stillness, the earth pulls itself out of the earth. The clay rises and drifts and wanders, and the world rearranges itself. Seeming to men like a herd of great beasts, they're managing, milking and eating and telling where to go and where not to go. I am growing horns. Even if this turns out not to be the case, I will reserve an aspect of it. Acknowledge that even if it occurred in what we call some way, even if it seems only to have been something like a guess that my mind briefly entertained, well, I will allow that it walks the earth. This person like me, except with horns, with horns like the tusks of wild boar, little tusk-like curves growing out of the bone of his sensitive temples. I expect for me, they will just turn out to be strangely symmetrical insect bites I got when I slept in a tree. Probably the kind of thing that happens to silly children and ask silly questions concerning the likelihood of they themselves having an outside. I expect for me they will turn out to be places I got jabbed by bramble or blackthorn while pretending to be a kind of human pencil, better defining a too sketchy line. I do not know what feeling means, and I do not really know how to say what it is that says this, but I do know that I want to claim it is not really a thought. I do not think I do not know what feeling means. I can allow myself to say that I know I do not know it, but not that I know what that knowing is supposed to be, if it is something distinct from feeling. I can tell you I have told myself that feeling is space. The previous sentence breaks apart in my world and makes a statement that seems a question or a series of questions. That feeling is space. What feeling is that? or are all feeling space? And what is space when it is at home? It is not easy to write that word seems. Seems a question. That word, like that word like, those words both interest and bore me. They make some part of me suspicious, that part of me which also considers the qualifier part of me to be suspect, at least as it appears in the sentences prior. Prior, briar, patch, the world of creation, beria, glitch, latch, and then the feeling thought of a kind of stuttering, her, the breathy attempt to think state the word hinge. The link with feeling is clear, and about as clear as the distinction. I feel the same. I think differently. Also, I would like to think that I think differently, but that is something else. Seems like I want to pair up seems and like with thought and feeling, and then feeling and thought in order to further confuse I don't know who in an attempt to reach a clarity that already is, only not for us. Who is this clarity for? Yes, I feel the same, only I think differently. Yeah, really, what just happened? It's very playful. It's very playful. It's like he's doing this like deep, heavy, ponderous philosophical thinking, but he's also doing it in a very sing-songy kind of way.
I mean, I think, I don't know if it was this that I was reading when I said, you play with words like B.P. Nichol.
Yeah, it's a very, very B.P. Nichol. So, Colin James is our friend who lives in Western Massachusetts, and he writes strange poetry that is sometimes delightful, and I hope he's doing well. He had some health problems not long ago, and hopefully he is on the other side of them and feeling his garrulous self again. And we have two poems of his of recent vintage, which is very encouraging.
So the first one is called Grotesque Beyond the Fantasies of Mad Dreams. My friend traced on paper the Ruthwell rooms as I paid off the Uber driver, told him to return in time for tea. A mist formed over the heather, churchless vestibule. Hadrian would have stood right about here, where the grass is more of a bottle green.
There is vaguely something called the Ruthwell ruins.
Sure.
I looked it up because it looked like a thing.
And Hadrian is...
Hadrian was like an invader or something.
Dip so dissociated necromancer. This particular dawn reveals the messiest burnt out circles yet. An orange ash outer edge, the inner yellow lighter. The living white robes have already left. Reds, after waiting patiently, begin to drift towards personalized motor coaches. The easiest method, find the going rough. Everywhere near a brush-barbed fence, litter caught like multifariousness. The reoccurring reminders and sublets, meteorological instruments don't touch.
What's that one about, Colin? I need to have my call to ask him about it.
And he would mumble. And
I don't know. What we published last time on Mad Jack, mm-hmm. Charlie and several other people were at a house... And they were having beers, and they were just shooting the shit, and Charlie was saying and thinking nasty things about the girlfriend. Then one of them gets to talking about this character he knew when he was young. That said, more Mad Jack.
Okay.
5. My new micro gang. After a week, mother was at her wit's end. The bums were sleeping in the living room and occupied the bathroom for hours on end. One of them was a clean freak and took hours-long showers, so much so that the water came through the floor and dripped into the room below. So the family, they're Quakers.
Yeah, they...
And they take in draft dodgers and help them on their way to Canada. So now they got a bunch of them in the house, and the mother's at their wit's end. There will be no more showers, declared Mom. Get these bums out of my house, or I'm moving you out along with them, she shouted. I'm not sure if this included me, but I knew it included Dad. Miraculously, Van showed up that morning, driven by a bleeding heart liberal, en route to the border 120 miles north. 4 of the AWOLs loaded up, but the most confused and delusional one hung back. He apparently had no identification and risked being jailed at the crossing. Dad proclaimed that he will help obtain papers and that Bob could stay with us until the bureaucracy was straightened out. That was fine with me. You have a living friend, not much older than me and considerably less intelligent. This meant I could control him like a slave out of water. Cool. Meanwhile, the rest of the POWs rode off to unknown fates, a few still wearing Dad's pants. So it became my lot to amuse and companion this renegade from his national duty. I always wanted a Frankenstein monster as a child. After consuming Mary Shelley's novel at age 12, I set off to the graveyard with my shovel. So this Bob thing was almost the answer to my prayers, if I was ever to pray a solemn word. Kind of like a big doll who agrees to anything and has a sweet disposition. Always there to empathize with, always offering drugs of any kind he may have, cigarettes, weed, booze, but only the light stuff a teenager could get their hands on. This was in contrast to my best friend, Scott the Red, who's dark and gritty. Ready to attack at a moment's notice, complain humorously about everything, and hoard whatever the other shared. His dad had dropped dead from his red-haired mother ragging on the beleaguered fellow. Then she'd married her lover, Frank, who was what some used to call Black Irish. Frank was a lover man and the escapee from two other marriages. Frank had three kids, and Scott's mom already had two. Together they made a six-month that was both red and black. My best friend, Scott. Home life was mother tearing at her hair and eating lots of little yellow pills, mother's little helpers, as they were called. Frank brought home a fat paycheck from the electrical union and the clap from his many affairs. Consequently, there was much screaming and dish smashing in the kitchen. The older girls went off looking to get pregnant, and the boys tried to become drug dealers. Scott, the youngest, just raised hell. I could feel the aura of anger when in Scott's personal space. A jagged cloud of pain around him, black with glowing red spots. At times he would whip out a stiletto and hold it to my throat to make his point on some trivial subject. I rewarded his moves with blazing boredom, and, though terrified inside, I calculated that he would not cut his best and maybe only friend. Bob, on the other hand, would go into a state of quivering, shrieking terror and whimpering to the great satisfaction of his tormentor. But as Scott could react without fear in situations requiring a hard-headed tude, including defending me, who was the cogitating pacifist of the outfit, Bob also had his talents. Between Scott's protection, my calculating brain, and Bob's gift, we made a reasonably dangerous micro-gang. Bob's gift became apparent in the kitchen one day. Scott's Valium-sodden mother had just baked a pile of chocolate chip cookies. As we greedily gathered around the plate, Mother announced, "You may each have just one cookie. Just one." Of course, we acquiesced and gingerly took just one cookie under the watchful and watery eye of Mother. Watchful and watery eye. Retreating to our lair in the basement, Bob shook his sleeve and half a dozen cookies fell out. "How the hell did you do that?" he asked. Simply put, Bob had lightning hands. I'd always wondered how pickpockets did it. It is, in fact, a fact that the hand's quicker than the eye. So he got a pair of bolt cutters from Scott's dad's shop and went out at 2 a.m. Son of a bitch, sorry. Oh, he has the Tourette's.
Right, yeah.
So remember, that's why he cusses occasionally. To steal paper coin boxes. After much gyration in the basement, we got the quarter box open and the coins spilled out all over the floor. Gathering them up in front of us, I noticed that Bob's pile was bigger than the rest. Grabbing his and readjusting the take, I still saw that Bob's pile was bigger. "What the hell, Bob? What? Why is your pile bigger than ours when we are looking at the quarters in plain sight?" I don't know. Scott reached for his knife and got it halfway out with a death look in his red, cool eyes. "Okay, okay, it's cool, man. It's cool. I'll show you." "Show us what?" "Get me a deck of cards." For the rest of the night, we watched as Bob turned one card into another, disappeared cards, pulled any card we could call from the deck, and astounded us by dealing himself a hand of aces. Things that would have filled him with lead at a Wild West saloon. And I knew just the place. 6. Anarchist House. When we woke well into the afternoon, and after a pint of Mad Dog wine for breakfast, we headed up to the Crane's house. This is a 50-year-old house that had never had a moment of repair or maintenance. They were proud of their unruly vegetation. Whereas the other houses in the neighborhood had the usual trim lawns and flower beds, this house is buried in trees and brush up past the second floor. A few dislodged gray boards were peeling off the house and could be seen through the trees. Inside was hardly better. There was a sudden blast of cat shit smell. The many cats themselves sat on the shredded furniture like contented little meatloaves. Others patrolled the floor, rubbing their ringworm on our pants legs. Bums, "Boy, Charlie!" And drugged-out people slept in old stuffed armchairs, waking with the cat's ringworm all over their faces. cat-high rubbish to wade through on the floor, and grit rounded out every corner. Yet a well-oiled mimeograph machine, as big as a small car, sat in the center of the so-called living room. It was used to mass-produce political handouts for us kids to distribute at rallies or concerts. It was the only thing in here in working order. With boxes of paper neatly stacked around it, it was like a new locomotive in a garbage dump. I wondered how this massive iron was wrestled in here. In this house lived an anarchist family of four brothers, all criminals, of course, a 500-pound communist intellectual father, and a mother who resembled a longshoreman with her one-inch haircut, no neck, and broad shoulders. As the gas company had shut off the house some years ago, she frequently sent us boys out on cold evenings to steal firewood in the neighborhood. And off they went. A few of the brothers in my micro gang headed up the worn steps to the upper rooms. The stairs and walls are black with age and grime, so a person could hardly see where he's going, giving the impression of walking into a black hole. Then suddenly, "And where in hell do you think you're going?" the mother yelled up at us, sounding like dragging a steel chair over a blackboard. "Aw, oh, shut up, Ma! We'll be upstairs!" shouted one of the brothers. Rudeness was a fine cultural amenity in this house. With a left turn, we came into a bedroom with no furniture. There were three brothers, two hangers-on, and the three of us. We scared the cats out of there and settled in for a few joints. When the giggling had subsided a bit, Bob pulled out a deck of cards. Scott and I sat across from Bob, so there was no possibility of handing off cards or other fishy business. At first, we played for dimes and pennies. Everyone won normally, Lady Luck making her rounds of the table. After 20 minutes of just fun play, I got a pretty nice hand. So I betted a buck, which was big money here. Some suckers went for it, and Bob gave me more great cards, even though I was five cards down in the deck to him. I didn't know how he did it, even though he'd explained it to me before. Surely a savant thing. Eventually, I raked in $12 with a full house. When it was Bob's turn to deal again, Scott made $15. A few hours and a few joints later, we were over $50. Excusing ourselves, we headed downtown to the non-stop cheapo movie theater, the Royale. Here they showed westerns 24 hours a day for a 75-cent ticket. Bums came in here to drink, smoke, and sleep. The seats were raggedy and the lights never dimmed out. Bums pissed in the aisles. Some say that when they put a drain down in the front of the screen, Puget Sound turned to salt. We were hardly better. The bread and sandwiches, two bottles of wine, and packs of cigarettes. Here he spent the next 6 hours in one-ton gluttony, smoking and drinking, throwing garbage at other bums down in front of us. 7. Mom's credit card. One time, I stole my mother's credit card. In those days, it was a big deal to have a credit card, and it was my mother's prized possession, having obtained it without my spend-crazy father knowing about it. Now I realized we were poor, and I couldn't actually spend a nickel on the thing, but I had a plan. At that time, a credit card was just a piece of paper with letters and numbers embossed in it. There was no computer connection. Funny bar, sorry! The card was swiped on a funny little machine that made an impression on the receipt. The receipt was layered with carbon paper, and when a sale was made, the purchaser got the top copy, and the retailer kept the carbon copies to cash into Bank AmeriCard later, which would then send a bill to my mother. We went downtown to the old Frederick and Nelson, a massive block-sized department store. On the third floor, you could buy tickets to the upcoming rock shows and the like. Doors were coming to town for a concert, and the tickets were $35 each. A fortune at that time. I bought 10 tickets on the credit card and was handed 10 slick-looking tickets. Then Scott made a fuss just down the counter claiming the price on some item was way out of line. He said he was going to kick somebody's ass. The clerk became all flustered and tried to console him, but his anger was everywhere. I got the nod from Bob, so I calmed down Scott with a crocodile smile, and then we beat a hasty retreat. In the bathroom on the ground floor, Bob pulled out a mass of crumpled carbon paper. I inspected each of the slips till I found the one that bought the tickets. Bob had, in a flash of his lightning hand, cleaned out the box where the sales clerk kept all of his copies, a standard shoebox. There were a dozen other receipts there, too, so other people would not get a bill for that fur coat, the extra underwear, or their door's concert tickets. We headed out to the University District, where we returned the tickets for cash, giving this or that reason for not being able to attend. $350 in criminal cash. I'm congratulated for a theft well masterminded. I pity their puny cerebral power. Now that we are rich, we head off to the drug dealer's place. Later, I slip the credit card back into Mom's purse. Our drug dealer, one of many, was a Vietnam vet. He had his guts shut up with some communist shrapnel, which further reinforced my loathing to go to Southeast Asia. By having no guts, he could hold no food in long enough to ingest nutrients out of it, so he was scrawnier than a willow tree. With no small intestine, the doctor gave him a prescription for pure opium liquid drops. We craved the opium. For this, we were constantly stealing things. Stereo sets, radios, cellarware, whatever we get our hands on. We'd exchange his booty with his skinny vet for joints soaked in opium. Damn, they were good. I'd drive us through dark roads in the hood as we smoked them, getting Bob more and more frantic until, like I recounted earlier, we could get him to charge into a convenience store with guns blazing. I made sure we were never actually carrying guns, including Scott, who had murderous intent on a minute-by-minute basis.
That's true.
Over the many months of that spring, Bob became one of my best friends. Always had an ear for listening, always had some odd angle on the subject, always there, always willing to get into any adventure, criminal or otherwise. My whole being was set up to create a few close friends, as my relations with my parents was orthogonal. I had no other confidants in my life other than these equally confused post-pubescent teenagers. I had no known friendship so deep, and we sort of stand by each other's side through thick and thin, unknowing how thick this life really is. 8. Induction Center. In time, Bob met other criminals to go and rob the world with. Scott married the gangster's mole who liked to hang with the bad boys. And I took off to a college 50 miles out of the city to try and change my life with education. At this time, there was a numerical draft based on your birthday at 18. My number came up as 37. This meant that I would be shipped out to Nam within 2 weeks. Elliot, sorry! I had an appointment to be inducted into the Army. To prepare, I drank shit wine, never changed my clothes or washed a fleck. I pissed myself and slept in the gutter. After a week of this, paint would peel when I walked by. I vomited on my shirt and left it. My shoulder-length hair was matted with filth and stood rigid on my head. In this condition, I entered the induction center. I firmly resolved to flunk all the tests. First, the written tests were in every round hole I put in a square peg. If a math question, I answered in letters. To some questions, I swore and made lewd comments. Not that I would ever do such a thing. If the answer was up, I was down. Jock fools were all around me, snickering and giggling at my nasty appearance. They were, in their crew cuts and clean t-shirts, letter jerseys, all salivating to go shoot little jungle nips. Soon, we were filed out to the physical examination, but I never got there. I was shuffled to a side room with a military psychiatrist. In there, I answered questions stupidly, my face drooling, my languid body nearly sliding out of the chair from spineless teenage torpidity. When asked how I felt about guns, I replied, "Guns, I love them! Give me a gun and I'll shoot everyone in uniform. I'll start with the assholes closest to me. Go on, give me a gun." The head shrinker closed his notebook with a sigh. He was getting familiar with recruits being insane and disqualifying for the military. He was not going to waste resources on that cases when there were so many gung-ho fools begging to go. Others of my ilk had worn a routed sheepskin, chopped off a finger or toe, and tattooed "fuck you" on the side of their hand, the side that presented every salute, of course. The notebook closed and the exit door opened. The gung-ho were prancing in front of the hernia checker, their tighty-whities lined up bun to bun. I burst out the front door into the freedom of sunlight, the freedom of a 4F designation, unfit for military service. Of course I was. Fit, that is, but the hell if I was going there. Meanwhile, the happy recruits filed out of the induction center and onto a bus that would take them to Fort Lewis, then take them to Asia, where their new life would end them up dead in a black plastic bag. I waved and laughed at them going to their doom, and they were still mocking me, giving me the finger, but I was free on the city sidewalk. I had the last laugh by miles. 9. The River of Life. I cleaned myself up and moved to a small town with a local college, with dreams of eventually getting into the university, but my dreams were crashed due to my errant youth that had neglected education and grades. Consequently, I had a GPA of 0.12 or lower. I had to prove I could be a smart student before they would let a city ghetto rat like me into their small-town community college. I got a moldy motel unit in an abandoned resort on a cold lake. The former business was under a canopy of cedars that held in the damp vapors from the lake. No mice infested the old units, only weird voles, which were some kind of miniature Lovecraftian semi-aquatic scurriers. In this oubliette of damp and dark, a fire blazed up in me to escape the confines of my past and the conventional path laid out before me. I wanted to excel in the new, the unknown, the undiscovered, the riches of the earth. I wanted to escape the hoodies of home, to escape a criminal future. I studied diligently, checking out and reading every book in the community college library, from cloud structures to chemistry, from history to hepatology. When I could, I'd drive out of town to a place where I could pan gold. This inspired a new avenue of study, geology and mining. In a year, I got into a major university, then another, then another. I ran two businesses and graduated late at 32. By then, having two kids, a wife, a mortgage, and 100 unrequited dreams, life moved a million miles from the hood and petty crime. Bob did not escape, but took up with some other criminal gangs and was now a full-time thief and drug dealer. From somewhere, I heard he was busted for armed robbery, but never heard more than that. Whether or not he'd ever been my best friend or just another parasite or a lost child, he was forgotten by me in the river of life. 10. Back at the outdoor dinner table. Back at the outdoor dinner table, we are all droopy and tired. I swill the last dregs of the long neck beer. It is night around us, the table covered in empty beer bottles. The grumpy woman has long since gone to bed. As the conversation is not about her or the things in her life, she's not interested. So what the hell ever happened? I mean, it's kind of interesting, but what's the point, I queried Jake. The point is that the crazies have the easy life, free to do as they please, supported by the government for being insane, for being total parasites in society. So whatever came of this guy, did he ever amount to anything? Well, in fact, he did, but not what you would expect. But I'm crowbait at this point. Let's continue this story tomorrow after dinner. The best part is yet to come, Jake assures us. We put on our jackets and wake the dog under the table. We each go to different houses around the village. We leave the mess of empties on the table for the woman to clean up tomorrow. She thinks she has value when cleaning. Why deny her? The next day we indulge in our labors, myself working on electrical wiring and Jake painting the interior halls of my cousin's new house. Jake and I could make a career of remodel on Jimmy's houses as he buys a new one every year, and they're always fixer-upper dumps, needing everything. But I'm just helping out as the cuz is a skinflint and the Howers are too erratic. Seems impossible to walk away with anything. But the food and the beer are free. The cuz is a proud slum landlord who charges large for roofs that leak and toilets that don't flush. The baggy wannabe girlfriend cooks a mess of high-calorie, sugar-soaked food and grumpily serves it at the end of the day. Pork parts in mushroom sauce, cinnamon rolls from the store, chips and cheese sauce, no veggies. I can live on all that, but it drives my blood sugar through the skylight. Jimmy's a diabetic also, although he doesn't give a shit. Never checked his numbers and pigs out on donuts and sweets of all kinds. Him and the cellulite cow have this in common. Constant eating of American processed garbage. I hope I'm in his will, but that's highly unlikely. The coolest member of this party is the hobo dog. It waits outside the country grocery and ever so gladly carries your grocery bags the 3 blocks back to the house. The dog is a masterless stray that lives to proudly carry grocery bags for those who pet him. After all the burping, farting, and spraying half-chewed food on the table, with some ejaculation by Jan about how stupid men are, Jake settles into his chair to resume the story. The cranky babe clears out the dishes and then brings out beer with a sour look. Kiss my red eye! Jake shrills across the table. We encourage him to continue after his outburst. With a large grin, he starts up his story again. Okay, so this is Labyrinthine, a new fiction. I've been writing this since 2006. It's over 4,000 pages, and I could not foresee it appearing anywhere but in the pages of the Cenacle, quite honestly. I think it is just far too massive to ever be a book of any kind. It would be, like...
It would be volumes.
So anyway, part 12.
I tell you there are more worlds and more doors to them than you will think of in many years.
George MacDonald. That's a good epigraph of part 12. Section 34. I arrive somewhere with a kind of pop from somewhere else, or maybe several somewheres else. Shake my head thrice to clear. Helps a little. Find myself sitting in an old wooden armchair, cushioned beneath me. A room, empty but me and the chair in which I sit. A door in the wall I face toward. Was I trying to find someone? I stand okay, walk to the door, take a slow breath, turn handle, locked. Am I locked in on purpose? Or does anyone know I'm here? What else to do but cry out, help, 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 please? I call and call and call. Then, wow, wonderful. Door handle turns and pushes in. I step back to see who. But what I see more greatly than who is what is beyond that who. 'Tis somewhere very large, a room or series of rooms, vast and tall, and books of all sizes and shapes and colors on bookcases that seem to reach into the sky of the unseen roof. I look and look, gape-mouthed. You, my good sir, are suitably impressed, says he, who I've walked by somehow to behold better. I look back at him and nearly recall, but not quite. Bald man strangely wearing an ear patch, dressed in clothes, a kind of suit, whose elements seem folded into each other. He carries in his hand a kind of walking stick, black onyx. I nearly recall, but don't. Holds out his handsome hand. Nolan, he seems to say, with a charming yet thoughtful smile. Raymond, I say, less sure, unsure, and yet unsure why. He nods, grins for some reason. I look around now, wonderingly. Could this be, I ask, unaware aloud. Nolan grins even more, if possible. You know the Arcadia? I nod uncertainly. I created it. Arcadia Bookstore and Cafe. From several bookstores I worked at back when. Coffee houses I loved and wrote years of hours into. He nods, listening close. Leads us to a corner table. Black metal table. Surface perforated with circles and diamonds and other shapes. I nod, remembering. It's called the Arcadia now, he says, studying my face for reaction. I nod. That makes sense. Leave it at that. Sips his tiny, bubbling drink. My tall paper cup of diet soda, with straw, in my hand like long there. Nod to that, too. So, he leads me politely. Yes, I answer vaguely. Sip. Where to? Where? And why, too? I sip. Wonder why him and all this now. Still, talk without plan. Where does the narrative of narratives go next? Even bigger? Much smaller? Go back and reinvent it all yet again? He nods, gestures around us, like this. I nod, too. Forward or back, or both? Both? He suddenly looks at me sharply. Confused, I don't reply, then nod. Sips bubbly drink again. Okay, so that's what you do. I nod. Seems so. He looks at me precisely now. I wonder that ear patch. Some artists don't like to look back. Some do almost nothing else. Maybe it's easier to choose. I don't. So the Arcadia is like what you do otherwise? I think of it like accretion more than anything. Oh my God, I love this conversation.
It is a funny conversation.
I think of it like accretion more than anything. He sips, thinking. Drink bubbles and bubbles. Fucking drink this.
Weird bubbly drink.
Looks up at me, shockingly handsome smile, even quite handsome now. Okay, yes, I can learn from you, if you would enjoy my company. I nod, so tis. Finish my soda with a sucking slurp and stand. Holy cow, the alliteration there is boggling. Finish my soda with a sucking slurp and stand. Notice my black book bag next to my chair. Good. Then notice that my soda cup is full again. Okay, good too. Nolan stands too. His book bag is much smaller, more like a stylish leather pouch. I can't tell how old he is, really, so I'm sure what he might learn from me. Ah, well, a companion will be nice. The floor below our feet is wooden, looks well-worn, long hair. 'Tis nice, and whatever that ceiling up there might be seems almost shrouded in clouds. Or is that a glass roof and those clouds visible through it? Just hard to say from so far below. Then we hear a strange sound. And the oddest-looking spaceship passes overhead. Looks like one of those tugboats you might see in harbors, but a spaceship?
Then you gotta read the next line.
Then a much larger ship passes over, and this one looks much more science fiction. Like that old TV show. Why can't I remember? I growling and mutter to myself. Remember what? Asked Nolan, curiously. Oh, I forgot. I shrug. Let's keep walking and figure out why we're here. Okay. We come to a sign. Mulroney the Space Pirate Reading Group. I read one of his books, Nolan exults. The one about the trial, I think. I nod. I should know that name way more than vaguely, but I don't. Spy another of those black tables and motion Nolan over to it. I look hard at Nolan for a good minute. You annoyed me at first, for reasons I do not know. He nods unhappily and unsurprised. But it was really that it could not rightly remember you. That's on me, not you, whatever it means. He nods again, more curious and unhappy this time. I try to smile sincerely at him. Fail. Take a deep breath. Try again. A small one comes out. Lift my heavy black book bag on the round metal table. I need the notebooks in here to help. Go and have an adventure here. I'm sure they're not hard to find. Then come back with one of your bubbly drinks and let's see what we see then, okay? He thinks, nods, smiles, and thinks again. Am I in there who I am? Looking at my book bag. I shrug. Maybe. I'll tell you if I find anything. Now get along. He nods again. Stan, you'll be here? He asks. Nearly falters to ask. I nod. Pat my book bag. Gesture him, run along now. He turns and walks slowly, then more surely down the central aisle, which branches off fairly frequently to side aisles of books. Good, okay. Maybe not having a companion for a while is what I need. Me, black pens and notebooks, and a self-refilling soda cup. Give my old black book bag a good look before diving in. Many pockets, I could not say exactly how many. One ragged sticker on it says Occupy. Another says War is Terrorism. Long time for sure. Unzip the several long pockets now. One notebook bags in News Volume 18, lavender color, Snoopy and Freezer Burn 09 stickers. Well-taped travel journal, Thoughts Pad I call it, silver-colored where not black duct-taped stickers, Portland Scene Symposium, Fluvaxed, Burning Man 2005, Other Side, War is Nothing to be Proud of, No More Drug War, I Got My COVID-19 Vaccine. These are just a start. The Strange Colored Secret Books, too. Thick volume of dream wraps. Will these help me remember? I start to read and read and read, looking deeper into book bag for the older notebooks, striped, strangely designed, some battered in cover, or the three metal rings holding pages. They pile up on the table, on the floor now, my self-refilling soda cup I have to keep an eye on. Okay, not to stop this time. Okay, not to care the distracting bullshit. Okay, some faces lack further contents. Okay, forgiveness is a process that may not travel to expected places. I keep this volume, this labyrinthine center among the rest, though others come into play as I study. There are far cheers that linger into this Arcadia. Yes, I know, 'tis the Rutabaga Festival in Fleestock. Not yet for me, guessing hopeful they'll wait for me. I read and read and read. I read beyond the care for readers or anyone really. I read because where I'm sitting is as far as my art has come, and maybe the whys are something buried in past pages. Maybe they are somewhat, I mean, why a bookstore? Because of all books have meant and do mean to me, they are part of what art is to me, though not all. Why Arcadia? A word rooted in the past, in antique ideals of living, of fairness to all, the world itself included. And the Arcadia Bookstore and Cafe I'd written a lot about, semi-biographical place, how I wanted to keep it. Arcadia as an idea sources in the ancient Greeks, a place of beauty and splendor, unspoiled wilderness. Thus applied metaphorically to a bookstore? Sure, that worked a long while for me. But then, more recently, I saw it becoming elsewise. Drop Bookstore and Cafe, left the Arcadia, that is here. From a dream, not surprising, an endlessly long, tall place of books. And who runs it? A kind of commune does. And me in the center? Okay, sure. Some of that. Not all. But still, who runs this and how? I'm sure I don't know. How extensive is it? Don't know that either. What do I know? This has become a bookstore of the many worlds. So that brings with it multitudinal unknown aspects. Not every world has books. Not every kind of being can read them. Other worlds have their own ways of transmitting what we do in this world transmit in books. Thus the Arcadia invites all to visit. What that evolves to, I could not say, but give it that welcoming a name, better damned well welcome all. At this moment I look up, and 'tis Nolan, as I think of him, returning. I nod to him to sit down, smiling and uncertain he does. How'd you do? It just goes on and on here. Did you want to return? Yes, what? I raise my hand, catch his glance in mine. Did you want to return? A moment, then he lowers his head, shakes no. It's okay. It is? Look at me. He does. I smile. I've seen one place you may end up. It's amazing. It is? Not even in this world. Where? I stop, pause, dreamland. He stares at me. I smile. You want my best mentoring? Go find the book, History of the Tangled Gate. Take it out. Read it. Did you write it? Not precisely. Meaning? I laugh. Meaning all of this, including you, is mine. But within this, it's multitudes of worlds and levels and identities. No, I didn't write it. Not sure who did. Find it. Read it. Maybe you find its author and school me later on, okay? He smiles. A real one. Dreamland? I nod. And the Tangled Gate? That too. How? You'll figure it up and show everyone how. Smiles again. He stands. One more piece of advice? He nods nearly eagerly. I serious up a moment. It's on my list every blessed day. Make art now. He nods like it lands. Turns and goes. To find that book first thing is my guess. All right then, good. Pack my beloved book bag up. Give that table a really affectionate pat. Missed you long. Get along. 35. Unsure next, or even if it should be me, but okay for now. I find myself hearing those distant festival cheers again, and feeling more easily lured this time. How the books and the white woods blend a while reminds me of the library at the heart of the worlds. Of course, and okay. But not long in arriving to the edge of the great clearing where is held the Thought Flea's Rutabaga Festival and Flea Stock. Funny, this book has somewhat veered away from this fest when the gentleman photographer and I parted the king at the shack at the threshold of the dreaming. I find a lovely white birch to pull out my notebooks and check the details. 'Tis dizzying to read my travels, often tossed from one narrative to the next and back again. Like that old space cowboy radio show. I say aloud, am I here? Is this now? It's my favorite line outside of Wings. Seems to be. I do the best thing I can do, if here, if now, and wait. And thus up walks Miss Flossie Flea, smiling kindly, a brilliant genius beyond my comprehensions. I nod her eagerly to sit with me if she would like. Like others in this Mythopoeia, Thought Flea's size to need. She sizes to perhaps an eighth of my height, still greater than me in all respects. Yet truly, Thought Fleas do not think in such meager terms, so I try to do way better. How are you, Miss Fussy? Very well, thank you. How are you? Nothing but true truth will do. I am trying, sometimes clumsy, to bring this great grand braided narrative to its grand finale, but I struggle. Why, Raymond? I think, really think. Then try feeling, see if that helps. Mix them together. My eyes tightly shut, and maybe I'm groaning. But she waits patiently. I sort it all out, some words, open my eyes, her smile kindlier than ever. I don't want to leave anything or anyone out. Is there danger of this? No. I've gone slower to try and assume this better. But you doubt. I point elsewhere. There, I doubt. That world back there, up there, what have you. Here, no. This world lives in me, with me, by me, through me. She smiles, twinkling. Is there a but? I shake my head. No. You and the rest are real to me. And by these pages, real to anyone or everyone else, too. Okay, then, what next? We go to share some soup together? She smiles, delighted. A good plan. I nod, put away the many notebooks I pulled out, stand, book bag, strap on shoulder, take Miss Flossie's paw, which she smilingly offers. The soup kettle is likely more ancient than it looks. I seem to recall, without checking my notebooks for sure, that it was in a thrift shop for a while. Even that recipe for soup was found in its interior. Yes, sure, details, but what about the bowls and spoons? Stone. Feel both very sturdy and yet light to the grasp. Designed on them? I study close, but hard to say. Miss Flossie nudges me with a smile to do more enjoying than simply studying. I smile back and do. Save my thoughts. Rutabaga soup, famed treat for all in the White Woods, Tangled Gate Mythopoeia as a whole, tastes like any good soup one has enjoyed. Also a light and heavy taste to it, but more to it, of course. It seems to dance within me, look around in me, curious as an imp. Seems to tend a little what kind of hungers ail me, soften, smooth, settle. Miss Fuzzy takes my empty bowl and spoon and guides me to a pretty white birch. Smiles me ever kind. Pawn chin a moment, she says. Scribble, scribble, scribble. Parts with a soft pats on my shoulder. High on soup? I chuckle, unsure. The catch up these lines to now. You working on your novel? Says a friendly voice, other side of my tree. Ha ha. Like, people used to ask me that on public buses. I guess so. How's it going? I pause, give my besouped mind a moment to consider. Been doing it many turns, not running out of ideas yet. He's quite quiet for a while. Well, just remember, there's always a new idea around the next corner. Just follow it. Thanks, sir, I say humbly. He mumbles a word and goes along his way. 36, the miracle of pressing black inked pen to blue striped white paper. Words come and thus my art continues. Amazes me ever. Dulls me never. Wonders me what next. Always. Door ever wide open. Vista a vastless view. Near 17 and a half years known this book, this new fiction, and my love blooms easily and always for it. What it is so far and what might the path bring. Endless meaning, deep fun. Within its pages I feel safe, feel sure, simply matter. Beyond its pages, this past year or so, I lost some of that good feeling. The page up I had, a good one, really good one, for several years, went bad when new management appeared above me, assessed my worth, found little, and did not stop until I'd been verbally assaulted en route to being laid off. I don't know why this happened, never will likely, but I do know that I fought them to the end, lost but never conceded to their assessment that I had less than no worth. Nobody else at the company but these two people believed their shit for a moment, but then honestly, none stopped it from happening. A few reached out to me once or twice. Most simply moved on. That's common. I kept writing this book through all of that, knowing as I do that my art is my forever companion. Pay jobs are not. They fund my art, Bungalow C, Scriptor Press, Spirit Plants Radio. It's a symbiotic relationship of a sort, I guess. 95 days of the nightmare of joblessness ended very recently. Tis why I sit in this attic study writing this book and more today, not beggaring for work as nearly every day since August 1st. Actresses 88, strange mellow electronica on attic radio via Jeefer, 68 degrees Fahrenheit. That sounds nice. I have some days to do my work, my various kinds of art, unencumbered by pay job, a preview of retirement one day sooner than later. A new job looks nice, hopeful from this moment's perspective, but not to begin for 3 weeks. So, this book, 4,068 pages. I want more deeper of it. I suspect I'll be throwing dice and coins again as part of my process. I myself may recede again from view, not always needed. I want to become a better human being, and not sure at all how that will happen. There are easier, more familiar ways to try to do this. But for me, this is also how to make better art, more of it, so it matters ever more. Some of it is simply a process of breathing again with less fear, learning how, remembering how to do this. In high school, long ago, I felt helpless to the control of people around me. I don't believe many cared to know me beyond a point. Likely didn't try so very hard with them either. We were all what we had then. But I also had art. It was my bonus? Gift? I don't know. Those words, but not comprehensively. But it suckered me during some hard days and traveled with me beyond them. Something of a parallel with these recent months. I had art all through it, no matter the bitch bastards who set their aim on me. They are gone from my life. Art remains with me ever and always. They rob me of a paycheck, but not of what I love the most. Not even close. I want this book to do what it has always done best. Leave me where I do not know. Lead me on. Land me a while to sort the what's out, then move along to next. So, where next?
Good job.
That wasn't bad.
That was great.
That wasn't bad. Many Musics, 12th series, 25, Night of the Wobble Moon. When the rain washes you clean, you'll know. Fleetwood Mac, Dreams, 1977. Been many and many a calendar page's turn. Been many and many since we last walked together. Been many and many since we last sat at table together. Been many and many to bring us back together tonight beneath that wobble moon high. Now many and many a strange story to tell. Many and many the faces loved, yes, many passed by and away. Many, many a kind word said and others bled, and still many and many led us, pushed us, impeded us, and let us yet still together tonight beneath that wobble moon high. Many, many a new path trod, new twists in the old skein, new wrecks to salve old regrets. Many and many come nigh, kept a little, we nodded, passed on through. Many, many a how and why, or no how nor why, smile each other tonight, touch and know again, touch and know. Come tonight, whatever past, whatever to come, together tonight, that wobble moon, high. It is Monday, September 2nd, 2024, at 2:28 p.m. Bungalow C, Saturday, Juice Room, Melkirch, Massachusetts. We are up to Bagsden. Bagsden is a fantasy land I've been writing about for a very long time. Next year is going to be the 40th anniversary of Bagsden News.
Wow, that's exciting.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
For the longest time, Bagsden stories, Bagsden News did not appear in any publication, with one rare zine exception. It was mostly just in notebooks, and I read it at the Jellicoe Guild. That's how it was known, very obscurely. And then some years ago, we figured out how to present it in the Cenacle, and now it has a place in the Cenacle, which is nice. What's cool about having it in the Cenacle is it means that it means I give time to both the writing of it. I also give time to the editing and publishing of it thereafter. I think writing it and then reading it and then publishing it, like, it makes the material more familiar, and I think it makes it more consistent overall. Hello, Mr. Elton Beagle. Oh, it's good to see you, ZZ and Lee.
Hello, afternoon. We are so happy to see you.
Hello. Hello, many friends. We're going to start into this story now. Bagsden book number 21. What is the creature carnival? Grand finally.
Good job, huh?
And it begins with section, the first section is called Welcome to X's Creature Carnival of Mysteries and Wonders, Grand Finally. Well, dear readers, this long story has involved many you more than in the usual stories I write in my beloved newspaper. While my creature common friend C.C. Willy Nilly, who is my newspaper's apprentice, plus those clever thought fleas on my nosebone, and the grand production producers themselves, the Royal Thumbs, usually on CC's hands, have traveled with me firstly in time and space for this grand production. Many of you, dear readers, have, of course, been following along from one act to the next. It was Act 4, really, that I began to hear about how popular this grand production is. It happened after me and CC had helped those nice creature bear guys, Melbourne and Wendell Berry and Sophie Horse 2, to unload all sorts of things, from the red and yellow truckee to help the creature carnival to settle into the great clearing in the White Woods. The last item I saw in the truckee looked like a big pot. Before I could think a big or little afeard thought about this, Wendell Berry said in his friendly old bear voice, "We need to put that somewhere safe for the thought, please. It's for their rutabaga soup." Again, that strange word. Am I strange not crying out, "Oh, yuck!" Not in the least. I just nodded and knowed that CC was probably looking strange at me, too. He knows my usual ways. Then Wendell Berry reached into the truckie's cab and pulled out a whole pile of papers. "These are letters for you, Mr. Eldrin Abigo," he said, though not meaning like a good joke. "From who?" I asked. "Well, they've been sort of collecting and following you folks and finally caught up," he sort of explained. Then he and the other fellows got to work hauling all the stuff we had unloaded. I was too shocked to help, and CC sort of led me to a quiet place to look at these letters. We sat under a pretty group of white birch trees, like what my dear friend Princess Chrissy has in Imagiana, and she told me their name and how they like to cluster together, sort of like creatures dreaming. CC set us up all in his lap, me and Willy Nilly, my apprentice, and the Royal Thumbs, of course. And when I peered on my nosebone, I could see lots of those tiny little thought fleas. He opened one of the letters. I could see it had an O and a Z on it, which usually means the Merry Old Land of Oz. "It's from Princess Dorothy Algernon. She says everyone in Princess Ozma's court has been reading about your travels with the Creature Carnival, and that the carnival is welcomed to make a new visit to Oz any time it would like. Cece greeted and said, "We all nodded at that polite invitation." Cece opened up another one. He greeted and laughed. "This one is from Miss Cassie." There you go. She says,
"I hope your trip is going well, and the creature commoners are looking forward to the last act."
Good job. Everyone agreed with that, too. He opened up a third. "This is from your teacher, Mr. Owl Algernon. He says he hopes you are learning all about the different ways of folks in different places." I'm not as much. I always do, but I think his teachings helped me, too. "Then I guess we must have dozed off for a while because it was nighttime when we waked up." Cece was piled high with letters from guys who were in the earlier acts. He scooped them up nicely for me. "I have often knighted before of the talented creatures in the carnival show we saw that night, which is full of their talents, the dancings and singings and hoppings by all their wonderful selves. But it was later when I got to see something I had not knighted about before. Nobody was left on the stage because everyone was in the grass together. It was pretty friendly and comfortable, and I didn't expect any more happenings. But then Cece brung me willy-nilly and the royal thumbs and the thought leaves on my nosebone towards something going on in the center of the clearing. As we got close, we saw it was those treasures from the creature common. They're red-striped balls, but they're sort of magical, too. They had their staff of three orange balls there, too, and some other balls, too, I think, all kind of arranged in a pattern, I guess you could say. And among them was a treasure staff guy who was not a round ball like the rest. He looked like a white, curly-haired monkey fellow, like that nice brown fur jumpy Jacoby, but for curls and colors." Cece said, "That's the ever-loving Preacher Poppy." I nodded and watched. Ever-loving Preacher Poppy talked in happy, sweet language like some other guys I know do, and he started dancing a long-legged dance among the treasures and their staff. I'm not sure how this would go, but everyone around me was cheering happily, so I watched some more. And I suppose it would not surprise many of your readers that the cheerings sounded like "hmming" too. It's like the treasure sort of "hmmed" and lifted a shadow of Preacher Poppy up and up and up into the sky full of stars. He was dancing with the forest and also up in the stars above and squeaking happy all the time too. Well, then Mesmer hopped and danced amongst the treasures, and her shadow was now up in the stars too. And it seemed like the treasure was sort of making it so more and more of us could do this. The "hmming" was even deeper than I heard it before, like there was drums inside it. I think the drumming got Cece dancing like the rest, and I could even feel a shadowy part of my own self now floating up in the stars too with all those dancing creatures. It was like I was looking up at me way down below, looking at me way high up in the stars. I've iterated before, dear readers, though not for dancings like this. It was like having a dream about yourself, sort of. I suppose at some late hour the dancings and drumming concluded, because the next thing I knowed was waking up early next morning in Cece's grasp, and many were clustered all around us, and I could see that there were many creatures and also many other kinds of, I guess, white woods dwellers in these clusters. Everyone soon waked up and sort of friendly began to get along their ways. I walked around with Cece, smiling and saying hello to folks. I am pretty sure you dear readers who visit the carnival would probably have a good time like this too. I thought we would travel with the Creature Carnival next to Act 5, but it happened another way. Not surprising. Cece smiled at me and said, "I have somewhere I'd like to show you, Algernon." Well, I was game, and again, not willy-nilly, nor the royal thumbs, nor the thought please objected, because Cece led us out of the clearing and deeper into the white woods. As we went, it was a long while of this travel, and I was glad he knew the way, because there was no road or nothing else to go by. Just pretty mysterious white woods. Then suddenly we came to a little hut. Its outside was colored like a sort of glowing white, like Mesmer and my carnival invitation envelope. "This is my very own hut, Algernon, for when I come to the white woods," Cece explained. I nodded and went inside. Cece's hut was just one room, but looked comfy for him. There was in the corner a nice old armchair, almost like what I got on Mill's porch. Next to it was a tall filing cabinet, and on the walls were many fine pictures and drawings of creatures, including that smirking clever Bella and that tricky little pandy bear Rosalita, and thought please too. And there was a little bookcase filled with books, and another armchair, and a weird sort of fireplace painted on the wall, but warming too somehow, and a kind of chest next to the comfy Cece armchair. Cece brought us to his armchair, and we seated in a close, friendly group. "This place sure is nice, Cece," I said. CZ nodded, but like he was sleepy, and I guess it was catching because soon we were all napping together. I woke, or think I did, because something was tickling my nose bone. I opened my eyes and see it was a little button. In midair, then I see it was attached to a thin wire that ran to the ceiling above us. CZ was awake too, looking up like I was. Up there is the attic, he explained. I nodded, thinking he would tell more. It's our way to Act 5, he said, like he'd forgotten that he hadn't yet told us, which he hadn't. I tried to think of some useful words. Let's go, I said, hoping for the best.
That's useful.
See, he smiled big and got to work. He stood it up, put me willy-nilly in the other armchair, and moved his armchair out of the way. Then he tugged on the button wire and pulled down a door and unfolded a ladder from this. Then he gathered us up again, and we climbed the ladder into the attic. We crawled along for a long time, and it was dark and quiet and nothing, I guess, to fear. Then it was like the darkness got lighter, and there was kind of like sounds of cheering far away, but getting closer. Finally, we just crawled right into the light. Took me several blinks to figure why it seemed like we were in a familiar place, and the guy smiling at us was too. It was Pillow Farmer Jones, but he was much younger and less beaten up by everything. His office was too, which is why where we had come now. I was going to talk, but then realized mid-try that this is probably long ago, too, and I should just let Cece do the talking. Welcome, my new friends. Come along to the show, he said, and helped Cece up and led him and us through his younger farmhouse and out to what I guess was the backyard. I had never seen it before, and there were creature kind of with tents and booths and creatures and everything. I guess this was not the same as where we'd just been, this being Act 5 and all. And there were many pillows as well as creatures in the walking around or for some bouncing among clouds. Farmer Jones talked to us some more. We have groups of our helpful pillows, trade turns, so that some are always taking care of our clients. Make sure your newspaper articles mention that. And he smiled as friendly. Now your old pal has your numbers far from the smartest cookie in the jar. Oh, wait, oh, cookies, y'all.
Okay,
but even I could figure out that he think we were reporters come to write a story about his helpful pillow farm. Now, I am some of that, and willy-nilly sort of too, and CC writes, but not a newspaper, I don't think. But suddenly, we all had pencils in our paws and hands, and we're writing notes. CC Sneaky did this somehow for us from one breath of Farmer Jones talking to the next. We eventually came around the farmhouse to where the pillow fields were. It's interesting to say that pillows grow in clusters like creatures nap. I tried to remember if that changed later on. But then I think, how are they coming and going from the clusters and roots to enjoy the carnival? I decided I better not ask, though. I just kept my pencil and notes close as we kept on walking to another side of the farmhouse I had not seen, and here was where the show was going on. But it was unlike any of the other shows I had seen in the earlier acts. At least the performers weren't, because many of them were pillows. CC bringed us to a side of the main audience. I think Farmer Jones would have given us an upfront view if we wanted it for our reporting pleasures, but CC found us a spot where we could see, but let's be seen too. Smart guy. Who knew it was in this crowd of pillows and others? Oh yeah, that too. Unlike the hard days later, and the better ones later still, it looked like non-pillows were welcomed at the pillow farm. It took a while to figure out the show itself. CC helped too. I think it's a show about the six islands, Algernon. In the center of the performance space, there are six pillows clustered together like the creature islands. You can count them. I believe you, I say quickly. Never too sure of my numbers telling true. Now look up there. See that great sea dragon? And look at those creatures leaping from him. There's a hummingbird, an owl, and a blondie. All coming down, down and down and down. Wow, what am I bagging in, folks? But I guess blondies probably get around more than most. Anyway, we watched them descend by wings, and I'm floating, and then five of the six creature island pillows spooked and bounced far away. There was more to come, but just then Farmer Jones showed up to us again. I am sure you reporters are very busy, and so I thought we should do our interview now. He said, all smiling and eager. Interview? But CC just smiled and nodded, and we left the performance to talk. Walked through the mostly empty fields above the farm, where I had been many times before, never this weirdly, though. CC gave me and willy-nilly look like, try to do like I do. So we tried. Interview with Farmer Jones. CC, Your farm looks so prosperous. Farmer Jones, thank you. We work very hard. Cece, your pillows help people, folks, to dream better, more hopeful. Farmer Jones, oh yes, well, we try. It isn't easy. People folks are sad and tough, too. Willy nilly, do you feel frustrated sometimes? Farmer Jones, sometimes, and I wonder if I should go back into the world and try to get us some help. At this point, I tried to blurt out, don't do it! It won't work out good! Because this was true. But Cece sort of tossed me up in the air. Look! This reporter wants to be in your show! Farmer Jones just laughed. I got the point. Cece stood up with us and thanked Farmer Jones for his good show and interview. Tell him they're all welcome. The carnival comes around a lot, but people folks are always welcome here. So Farmer Jones smiled and waved at us and returned to the helpful fellow farm, and we walked the other way. Then Cece stopped and said to me in arm, Algernon, can I borrow your pinecone necklace? Of course, Guy, I said friendly. He found us an oak tree to sit under and set me willy-nilly together in the grass near him. Are you going to talk to the thought leader on my nose bone, I asked, or record your thinkings? Cece shook his head. It has another trick, Algernon, that we need now. What's that? Watch. And he talked into the pinecone necklace. R.E.M. was the best band ever in the whole wide world. It was a blink or maybe less, but we suddenly were somewhere else again. A room with green light, soft cushions on the floor with strange designs, funny pictures on the wall. Oh, I cried, Princess Grizzly's secret room. Cece nodded. Then they had a glum thought. Is it long ago again and she doesn't know we're here? Cece nodded. Again. It's okay, Algernon. You want to get the story right, don't you? I nodded, still glum. Then the royal thumb spoke up. It's many kinds of lessons to learn in doing this grand production. Unnodded, but listening, we had to learn how to tell the story best in each place. Nod, and the audience has to learn the many ways to be an audience along the way. Okay, I see, finally, but Chrissy and Boop are so smart. How do we be here to watch without them knowing? Then Cece smiled full. Do you remember the dark creatures, Algernon? Yes, they were really nice. That's who we need to see. So Cece picked up me willy-nilly, and he had the real thumbs already, and the thought please on my nose bone, and he led us out of the secret room. Lucky it was nighttime, or maybe that's because it was Act 6, but I guess it was a good time to be finding those dark creatures. It seemed like once we came out of Chrissy's secret room, it was the royal thumbs leading us along, like they knowed where to go in this beast of a castle. I figure to talk about now what I knowed of the dark creatures of the castle. We gotta close our eyes to see in the dark places here like they do. They will guide us along, too, if we ask nicely.
That is helpful.
I think that was helpful to know, and didn't seem off script to say. We all closed our eyes and moved along the lightless corridors we were in. You royal thumbs had better be ready for some lost audience members in this act, I said to them, as they were still leading the way, as Cece carried the rest of us along. Don't worry, Mr. Algernon Beagle, said the royal thumbs. The dark creatures live in this act and will care for all. Here they come. Oh, and Cece, they might float you in the very air itself, so watch out, I warned again. It had been fun the first time, despite my usual hard relationship with gravity. Cece laughed. And we suddenly turned into a room that was darker than ever to my peak, but eyes tightly shut, I could see okay. And there were indeed a lot of dark creatures in the room. It's hard to describe them because they look like shadows as bodies, led by the pointing royal thumbs and encouraging dark creatures. We eyes shut tight, walked across the room to what looked like a big glass door that opened up to a balcony view high up on the outside of the castle. I had never seen this balcony before. I noticed there was a comfy-looking armchair by the railing, and Cece and the royal thumbs brung us right over to it, nearly as nice an armchair and view to see as my Milne's porch, nearly. Look, Algernon Beagle, Cece and the royal thumbs willy-nilly, and maybe some of the thought-fleas on my nose won't say together, and we all saw the creature carnival rolling up the green and golden hills near the castle. Was this long ago? It must have been. Chrissy had never talked about a big carnival visiting. She doesn't always tell stuff, though. I have to say, watched from this high-up balcony and all, I could see how hard and fast the creatures worked to put up their show. By the time the full moonlight was becoming early morning time, every tent was up Every wagon was parked and every booth was ready for all comers. But all who lives in Magiana is Chrissy and Boop, and I guess you dark features, I say to the ones with us. Chrissy is their princess, Algernon, say T.C. You mean the same one who iterated them from the island cavern all those acts and calendars ago, I asked? T.C. nodded. That's why they came to see her, he explained. I think they nodded, then think twice more and nodded once. I guess what's good for the iterie is good for the iterer, too? T.C. nodded and smiled. So they came to visit her and Boop in their new home? And they have been coming every turn of the calendar since. Say the new voice behind me, but I know it very well, and I know better that you can't fool that voice's own person. It was Princess Chrissy, and also her bestest buddy Boop, who is not a turtle but looks like one. I felt like a sneak and a thief, and like I had started a rubble or something. But Chrissy was smiling way too big at me for being angry. Then she put her finger to her lips like, shh, and she and Boop started switching with me and Cece, willy-nilly, and the Royal Thumbs, and the Thoughties, and the Dark Creatures. Good thing many of them were scrawny little creatures. Why are we shushing, Chrissy? I asked, but quietly, though. Because I am down there, too, and it's a really good night for the Creature Carnival, she said, smiling and hugging and still whispering. I guess it had to be some of that old tricky smile Chrissy magic she got from her sister, but it's like we could see from our high-up balcony perch right into the best performing going on down below. They brought out all the best performers, too. Those rarely seen La Petite Thumbs put on their escape artiste extraordinaire performance by diving, I swear, from a strange little tugboat in space with an impish captain. She cried above and cackled merrily, and these thumbs, all twisted and bound up by ropes, sort of leaped from this tugboat and started hurtling down, down, down toward the big tent, and there was a hole in it, and when they appeared again inside, they were all loosed up and landing with such pretty grace. And amazing to see but true, Princess Chrissy walked into the center of the three-ring performance areas, and for a moment she stood there, looking around at all the creature performers near her, and the ones in the audience, and they got very hushed in the tent, like important in a way Chrissy usually doesn't. Then she talked. Like I kept you in the great cavern with me, and also sent you along the road as a great carnival to entertain and comfort, mostly people folks, but not all, so now I iterate you again from here, one as this carnival traveling ever on, the other as a group I bid to find a new home, a common, for all creatures to be welcomed, for everyone to be welcomed. Then she raised her fingers to the air, and drew it slowly down and down, and voices, the prettiest voices of all, began to... tell another Chrissy gesture, and everyone began to join in, and it's like it got deeper and bigger and softer and quieter all at once. Dear eaters, I've never experienced anything like this. After what seemed like whole lifetimes or more, I know it sounds like I am one of those wild exaggerated folks you hear tell of. I found myself back with nowadays Chrissy, and here to Cece, and Willy Nilly, and the Royal Thumbs, those crazy, brilliant, genius grand producers, and even, hello, Algernon Beale, remember us? Shouted the many, many funny little voices on the very tip of my nose bone. Hi guys, I said, but looking down, saw no colorful was there at all. I looked at Chrissy and Cece and all and just said, wow, I think those nice dark creatures had left, humble and nice as any creature I know. Without much need for help, Cece carried us and we followed Chrissy back, but strangely not to her secret room. We were now in her throne room, and she was sitting on her throne looking at us. She looked uncomfortable, no matter all of us old friends with her. What is it, Chrissy? I asked. Tell us, princess, said Boop. She smiled at all of us. Well, now you know more of the story of the Creature Carnival, its travels and reasons. Then I asked the question that was puzzling me. Why did you make the creature common and then have it so far from you, like you told it me? She smiled, still not very Chrissy-like. I wanted them to have a new home. It had been long enough just on the road. Now they're under the tangled gate, in the great cavern, and traveling as the Creature Carnival, near and far, and also at home in the Creature Common. And what else, I asked, though I can only say it was more like a sniff with words. Having a home, neighbors, place in things for when I call on everyone to do something for me. Do what? Why was I terrified of what her answer might be? She looked at me calmly, though, till I breathed with ease. Thank you. I want to reunite the six islands, she said. Did I pass out? Next thing I know, I was in that nice Creature Commons Saturday room. Look at this. With Cece and Miss Cassie and all those nice creatures looking at me. I think the final act of the grand production occurred then, and in the great clearing, where something very strange and dear to me bubbled in a big soup pot, and tiny little charming fellows fed every cold and hungry guy and fella in the White Woods. Oi, Huck, hold off for now, please. I sort of remember very talented dancing bears and that white bunny and jumping Jacoby and an encore of those petted thumbs, petted thumb even. On the Bags End Auditorium stage, Shlia's cool jazz band blew Miles and Train and Bird and all those funny named jazz guys as others leaped and danced and sang along. In Dreamland, Benny Big Dreams showed off his new trick of double and triple stacking dreams until they seemed to be having each other and you only needed to sleep and watch. On the Dream Pillow Farm, which used to be the Helpful Pillow Farm, Farmer Jones showed Betsy all the good newspaper stories there had been about the farm until he decided to leave back then. I think that Betsy and Jones waked up peaceful together for once. I can say for sure that she isn't in Bags End right now. All this was going on in the best of good fellowships, in the greatest of grand production styles, but I sat there dazed, dear readers. It's where I sit now, all of this going on, all these good friends and talents, but I am whispering these words into the little pinecone necklace I will hang on a hook for a little while anyway. Wondering, dear readers, dear neighbors, what did Chrissy mean? What does it mean to reunite the six islands? I need to know. I need to find out. The end for now. Oh, thank you, fellows. Thank you, one and all. Now we're going to go to our field trip. First is Martina reading her poem, Porch, which is in the Sun at Home. Next is Nathan D. Horowitz reading his piece, Night Bus to Quito, in the Sun at Home. Then Timothy Vilgiati, and his radio program, Escape from Horizon 1, which is also in the Senegal.
Hello. My name is Martina Reese Newberry, and I'm here to read Porch, which is a poem that's from my book, Beyond Temples. We cast curses at the moon, watch its face travel over, then behind clouds. Then come to the fore as if beckoned when it most certainly was not. Booze and blackberries on the front porch and the cries of dead beasts and warriors out there. Imagine it. Hold it in your head as you do song lyrics and prayers. The strange sense of late nights and the ill will we've encountered in others. We talk of these things, bring them closer. Oh, the madness of this porch, how it dares to receive our complaints and our compliances, how it rests under our flip-flops and naked toes, how it shifts under spilled sweet tea and dripped foam off cans of Bud Light. Does it make you grin that I've said this? So the moon hovers, and we here below pull it over us. Imagine it soft, when, in truth, it's as dense as a mango dum-dum. Inside, we look for rest, knowing our mendacity could pull down the stars, knowing our joys are simple masks for grudges, the way they jibe. My God. The way we consume bitterness, fill our plates, pour on gravies and sauces of fear, then dare to sleep on that repletion. End.
Night Bus to Quito. 1. Last night around midnight, on the way up out of the jungle into the mountains, I awoke because the light was on inside the bus for some reason. I watched the landscape outside flowing by through the reflection of my face, like an animated surrealist painting of plants racing through a man's head. I remembered a poem my friend Virge Basso wrote in high school about looking out the window of a train outside of Basel and seeing the landscape flow by through the reflection of his face. Verge died in a kayaking accident in New Zealand 2 years after I last saw him. The light on the bus went off. My face vanished, leaving the plants like a dark river. Just as Verge and I vanish and the world flows on without us. But maybe it's only an insubstantial, mortal reflection of us that vanishes. Above the plant river were mountains like buttocks and breasts of darkest green, reminding me of Verge's girlfriends, with the soft gray-blue cloudy sky floating over them, reminding me of his hands. Landscapes and faces flow through each other, and Verge's face drifts in through my words now, brown-eyed, big-nosed, thoughtful, calm. I dreamt about Verge twice after he died. The first time he told me that for a week after he died, he'd eaten cabbages and the tops of waves on the river where he drowned. The second time I visited him in the land of the dead where he was writing plays at a community theater. He introduced me to some of his friends who were young, gifted, and dead. Dead thespians, I learned, have a tool we don't have in the land of the living, a smooth clay they can put on their faces to transform their features any way they want. I asked, but wasn't allowed to bring a jar back with me. 2. A tranquil, bearded, fat guy was my seatmate on the bus, flowing into my space. As in Laurel and Hardy movies, the fat guy always spreads out sideways, and the tall, thin guy gets pressed and pushed taller and thinner. This fat guy was nice, but he should have brushed his teeth more often. He might have been a scientist deliberately using his mouth as a petri dish to cultivate bacteria, or maybe on a previous bus ride a mouse had crawled in between his cheek and gum and died. For a while we were passing streetlights off to our left, so it looked like the bus was overtaken again and again by its own shadow, which was joined to it at the wheels. I closed my eyes and let my own shadow overtake me. On a bright spring day, I'm swimming laps in a well-lit pool in the city. Through the immense half-open windows, tall buildings are visible. 3 meters above me, the ceiling of this room is the transparent floor of another pool. I can see people swimming up there, and above them, warped by the rippling surface of the water, the ceiling of that room, which is the transparent floor of another pool with people swimming in it. Finally, above that, skylights and sky and sunlight, fragmented and distorted by the light rays, dance through 2 levels of water. Below me, the floor of the pool in which I'm swimming is also transparent. 2 more levels of brightly lit pools are down there for a total of 5. I wake for a moment, remember Verge, and drift off again. The water is full of reflections of me and all the other swimmers from various times in our lives. I catch the eye of myself as an old man. We exchange gnomic telepathic utterances. 3. Mid-morning in the colonial center of Quito. I'm in a restaurant munching an empanada, sipping coffee, and being crooned at by a radio as my hosts fill their deep fryer with El Cocinero cooking oil. And the song, a woman is weeping. Just an illusion, moans the male singer, nothing more. In the mirror, I ogle a sexy wall calendar. A woman wears a leopard skin bikini bottom and a bunch of gold necklaces that cover her nipples. Standing behind a soft focus agave plant, she holds a bottle of orange soda with both hands on top of her head. She's looking off to one side as the evening sun makes her artificially lightened brown hair glow. My own reflection is an immense white-skinned monkey staring seriously at me. The restaurant owners aren't looking, so I experiment with various expressions, ferocity, surprise, confidence, none of which quite works. This makes the pale monkey stare back even more seriously than before. Who is that guy? His staring at me seems a challenge. I consider running up to him, screeching, waving my arms and baring my teeth in a threat display, but I quietly return to my empanada and my coffee. I sometimes steal glances at the bleach brunette in the sexy wall calendar. 4. Now I'm outside in the smell of apples on the northern steps of the massive, majestic stone church of San Francisco, near the vendors of candles and incense and images of saints. I just poke my head in the church and glance at the celebration of Mass. A girl in there is wearing a Marilyn Manson t-shirt. I don't know whether as a protest or because it's her Sunday best. A beautiful young mother walked up past me. She paused and stood over me for a moment to glance at what's developing as my pen mates with my notebook. Just an appendix to the Talmud, ma'am, I thought. A poor man's popol vuh, an instrument for seeing. Many people are swarming around just below in the street market. Sometimes I see my writing as chapter 14, ma'am, a flashback in a much longer work whose other authors have not yet been born. A urine smell when the wind shifts, then apples again. Here, chapter 14 smells of piss and apples. 5,000 sucres apiece for the clothes and cardboard boxes at the foot of these steps, a bit less than a dollar. The sun burns down past fluffy white clouds, the sheep of the sky. The bell tower of La Merced, another church, is straight ahead down the street. Amor de mi vida, wails a singer on someone's tape player. A dog chases a pigeon in the plaza in front of the church. A phone rings at a booth selling belts. The sounds of hammers and saws, renovations inside the church. Clothes on sale, bellows a mustached man hoarsely. Pigeons preen on a tiled roof. One takes off with a sudden clapping of wings. With a ring of wire brushes stuck on his head like a crown, a boy dances. He's trying to sell the brushes, but as there are no takers at the moment, he might as well dance with them. The pigeons are plump silhouettes against the sky. If they were beautiful or tasty, they'd be caged or killed. Their worthlessness is their salvation. A flash of blonde. A gringa tourist ascends the steps, wondering perhaps if I'm writing about her. A young husband helps his very pregnant wife up the stone steps. Big steel serving spoons for 5,000 sucres. A cloud intercepts the sun. The air cools and dims. Capricious breezes whirl around everywhere, bearing the yin-yang smells of piss and apples. Topless mannequins stare dumbly at a blue jeans store. Literally topless, they end just above the hips. I imagine them marching down the street. The human tide is rising. When will it turn?
Before we begin, I'd just like to give a quick reminder that Rivers of the Mind is not meant to condone or promote any use of drugs, illicit or otherwise. Thanks. Let's begin. Episode 9, Escape from Horizon 1. Dormitory hallway hummed with a sharp and foreboding timbre, seething with the various languages of the nocturnal drug. languages of sleeping pills, painkillers, and sedatives prescribed to the various inhabitants of the base. Languages that filled every inch of the hallway with varying shades and colors of silence and slow-burning fire. No one was sleeping easy that night. Almost intuitively, I slipped into the mushroom language. My pupils dilated, and it became easier to see down the hallway. Light from a tiny beeping fire alarm illuminated the whole corridor in intermittent bursts of red. Though each groan of metal or sound from beneath a door made me fear that the white flowers were moving in to attack me, my heartbeat in my ears acted like a war drum, filling me with courage. Confidently, I pressed on. As I wound my way further through the building, I started to hear whispering voices, just barely perceptible through the air vents. Closer to the administrative section, they became more intelligible, at least intelligible enough for me to recognize them. Marine and Bobby, discussing the day's events in fearful and awestruck tones. I turned to move up the stairs, which I remembered going down to get to my room earlier that night. Hearing my footsteps, Marine sharply cut off Bobby. Shh. Someone's coming up the stairs.
What? What do we say?
Just say we couldn't sleep. Turning the corner, I could see their shadows cast against the wall by the faintest light of idling electronics in the administrative section. Marine? Bobby?
That one chick. What's her name?
It's Megan. Couldn't sleep either, huh? No, I couldn't. When I emerged to the top of the stairs, the two both looked me up and down. Marine's face twitched. Surprisingly, her eyes had changed. Their shape was now rounder, her nose more acute. She looked knowingly at Bobby. What? Something wrong? I didn't know what to say. What do I look like to you? What color hair do I have? Nervously, I gulped, fearing that I'd stumbled into some kind of trivial argument that would hinder me from finding tobacco. Brown? Bobby shook his head. And what color are my eyes? Blue? I wonder what that means. She scratched her head. This wasn't a trivial argument, I started to realize. Marine had been changed by the accident, too, and now she was trying to figure it out. No psychic presence had been there to guide her through this change. No explanation or forewarning had been given. She was horrified, yet masked her fear underneath a confidence not at all misplaced in her ability to figure it out. She liked puzzles, I could tell. The mystery of all this enthralled her as much as it scared her. That's what you look like to yourself, isn't it? I got it.
Well, hell no. I don't look like a...
What does she look like to you?
I don't want to talk about it.
Marine squinted at me, studying my widely dilated pupils. You don't think I'm crazy? Of course not. I
noticed it too.
You've changed somehow after the accident, right? Yeah, I mean, the mushroom, something is going on here. Something is going on.
I think that I have a buddy who saw that guy in the hospital room around town.
Mumbled Bobby, sitting down and working on unbuttoning his shirt. He felt very hot, very drunk, and very tired.
It's really weird. I don't think this is... Maureen, what did I say earlier? Ah, fuck, man. It's happening again.
He looked up at her to finish his sentence. This lab still does whatever it did in the 60s. I just know it. Only they figured out how to get results. Like that Netflix show. Strange Places, or whatever. Well, actually...
Bobby,
show her what you can do. Bobby took off his shirt and stood up, irritated and stumbling. Suddenly, his body erupted into weak blue flames, burning the sweat from his skin. Once the flames subsided, he was no longer drunk, but he seemed terrified as his drunkenness already started to creep back up on him. What about you? It's kind of complicated. I really wish I could stay and talk about this, you guys, but I've got to go. Where are you going? I need to go find tobacco. It's really important. Maureen rolled her eyes, reaching into her back pocket to hold out a cigarette box. Not that kind, I said, pushing away the box. I need real tobacco. It's urgent. I don't have much time. Tell us why, begged Maureen, gripping my arm before I could turn away. You can trust us. This is really complicated, but if I don't find some tobacco, some flowers are going to kill you all with their minds. I swear I'll tell you more later, I whispered, pulling my hand away and running to the administrative center, the main area of which was locked, although a corridor leading to the tram entrance was still open. The tram entrance was guarded by two guards, who sat drowsily in rolling chairs with automatic weapons at their sides. I switched into the English language so that in case I had to interact with them, I could do so without seeming like a loon. Maureen and Bobby followed me a few yards behind, thinking that I didn't know they were following me. It was annoying. I knew that they thought their conversation was really important, and it must have seemed very important to them at the time. But as curious as I was about why Maureen's face looked different to everyone and why Bobby had to light himself on fire every couple of hours, I was also really frustrated and didn't want to waste any more time. The guards spotted me approaching the gate and rose from their seats, ordering me to stop. Almost without thinking, I pulled them into the language of silence. I grew weak at the knees and started to feel myself fall down. I didn't care. Silence was all I needed, embracing me like a long-lost friend. Silence pulled me in. I watched as drowsiness overcame the two guards and made them pass out. Strangely, I was still awake. I stood up. Oh, fuck no. I was already standing. Yeah, right. Wow. Whatever. I mean, what do you care? What I do, you fucking asshole? I just... Fuck. I need to get out of here. I need to get out of this... fucking... language. I tripped over my feet while I went to grab the officer's ID badge. Shit. Totally forgot what I was doing. Hey, go fuck yourself! I shouted, flipping off Bobby, Maureen, and everything, basically. Man, this language is awesome. I heard one part of myself say, no, it's not you, dumbass. You need to get your shit together, I replied. Fuck that, retorted the other part of me. But I guess I've got some important shit to do. I think... I struggled to make myself swipe the card and unlock the gate. I pushed as hard as I could against the silence as my head started to grow heavy and my eyelids droopy. The silence loomed below my feet like a monster made of infinite void, a monster trying to wrestle me down into its murky depths. Yet I simultaneously saw it like a welcoming pair of arms, ready to wrap themselves around me. And...
Stay with me for a while. We need to keep this
safe. Oh, shit. I'm in the tunnel. Fuck. How did I get here? I finally withdrew from the silence, having walked through most of the tunnel in a half-sleeping haze. Emerging into the open air, I headed towards the gate, security pass in hand, before I saw two translucent frames making their way through the forest. Just barely, I could see the outline of John talking to one of the ghosts I had seen in Dr. Whitebaum's laboratory. For just a moment, I watched them. They were too far away to hear. But I decided again that I did not have time to waste investigating whatever it was they were doing. I swiped the card at the gate to make my exit and headed down to the road. It felt magical to return to the open air, to wander under the night sky. So magical that it was easy to forget my mission, or at least let it slip to the back of my mind. In the mushroom language, I felt that I found a miraculous harmony with the earth. Exhausted as I was, the night air seemed to replenish me. This world was my home, and I felt at ease, free, within it. The light of the moon, just a phase past full, shone in a sea of stars and incandescent clouds. Noise from passing cars scattered over the dense wooded hills in shattered jewels. The dirt under my feet swelled like the breathing chest of a sleeping giant. The trees hummed soft homages to the sky. Frogs in the ponds by the stream-eyed insects with hungry stomachs, shooting out their tongues to swat them from the air and yank them into their mouths. Tiny fish babbled through the creek, hunting for algae on the river rock, alone in a minuscule world of water, which seemed to them to be the entire universe. But when my feet touched the pavement, something inside of me seethed. An all-consuming anxiety, a frustrated rage at the separation I now endured. The city, small as it was to the English parts of my brain, seemed an immense and menacing abomination of flickering, off-colored, artificial suns and steel monsters in the psilocybe language. I clutched my stomach and uncomfortably returned to English. But even in that language, the city felt miserable, since my brain remained covered in beshroomed sensations. An unsettled paranoia crept up the muscles in my spine and my neck. The headlights of passing cars seemed like eyes that studied me with disgust, fear, and rage. I felt sad, no longer confident, no longer brave, but suddenly exhausted, cognizant of how terrified and hopeless I felt in my whole body. My teeth chattered, not so much out of cold, but out of fear. I retreated from the sidewalk and onto the grass, breathing deeply to try and calm myself by looking at the moon. "Hello, moon," I whispered.
"Hello, Megan."
The moon was reassuring, but what could I say to the moon? Did it even want to talk to me? I imagined it turning its nose up at me and saying,
"I am so much better than you, Megan. After all, I am the moon. And you were so rude to Maureen. Why would I even want to speak with you?"
And I guess that really had bothered me, you know? Being so mean. I felt like I should have taken the time to support her through her struggles. With, you know, looking weird and not really knowing what was happening. "I'm sorry, moon." The moon, being a large piece of rock, did not actually reply, but instead, in my imagination, let out a palpable sigh and told me,
"It is A-okay, Megan. I'm not mad at you at all. You are on good terms with the moon."
I sat down on a bench and looked around the city. Vaguely, I could make out a smoke shop, but they wouldn't be open now, not at 4 a.m. Perhaps a gas station was my best bet. I scanned the horizon for gas stations. A single 7-Eleven sat about 1/2 mile down the road. I took off for it, walking as quickly as I could. I flung open the door and immediately headed to the front counter to look at the tobacco. The fluorescent lights cast uneven and strange colors over the room, making it seem like a sort of awful carnival attraction.
"Can I help you, ma'am? Ma'am? Excuse me. Can you hear me? If you don't respond to me, I'm going to need to call the police."
"Can I see those cigarettes?"
"I'm going to need to see your ID."
I hadn't grabbed my wallet. Of course I hadn't grabbed my wallet. Oh well. Maybe I could figure out a way around it. Maybe I could just tell them the truth. I just want to talk to them. I need to hear their languages.
"What?"
"I need to talk to them. The spirit ones, probably."
"Ma'am, I'm gonna need you to show me your ID. You're gonna have to leave."
Just then, the door sprang open.
"Megan, what the hell are you doing here?"
"Wake up. Is that really you?"
"Is this your sister, Jake?"
"Yeah, she is."
"She autistic or something?"
"Well, don't worry, I'll take her home. But anyway, I just came in to buy a few of these. Did you see that shit with the fucking terrorists? Shit, totally like a giant fucking sinkhole, 10 feet from my house.
Jacob pulled 3 5-hour energies out of a rack and set them on the counter, along with a wrinkled $20 bill. The man, seeming to feel bad for Jacob, sighed and took the money. Jacob led me out to his car.
Megan, what are you doing here? Are you okay? I thought they said you were a witness in the investigation with the sinkhole or whatever. You are Megan, right? You didn't get body snatched or something? Shit, what a fucking day.
The two of us got in, and quickly down to 5-hour energy. In his mind, I saw a flurry of languages, one of them still embryonic and warm, so inaudible as to seem practically insignificant. Another that now entered his body matched the language of the coffee tree, and then overpowering them all, an immense insectoid presence I knew at once to be methamphetamine. I shut my eyes to see what it looked like. And all at once, I found myself in a field of crystalline grass, higher than my eyes could see. The brush against my skin like silk, giving a gentle electricity. An intelligence loose in each blade and in the ground beneath. A language of motion, alertness, activity, visceral and soul-searing awakeness. But the mind did not come from the grass. Rather, the grass came from the mind. Trillions of tiny insects looming in this vast, open plain urged me forward. They like their prey to run. My eyes shot open and back into England.
Do you need to go to a doctor or something?
I need to find tobacco.
Well, they probably had some in the gas station. Do you not have your ID?
Not that tobacco. Real tobacco.
What do you mean, like Indian tobacco?
Yeah. Yes. Do you know where I can find some?
Like a farm? Probably a farm. I mean, there's a lot of farms around here, and maybe they have tobacco or something. But I don't think there are any Indians around here. We could look, but... Wait, why do you need to find tobacco? What's going on?
So, remember how I told you about that weird homeless guy who came into work?
Yeah, I remember that. What does he have to do with it?
Well, he's a psychic. My brother's eyes grew wide. Just then it hit him. I looked like I was tripping. Tripping really, really hard. And my neck and shoulders were covered in faint blue bruises.
He's a psychic?
He asked, seeming to try and take me seriously. Yeah, he's a psychic. He visited me in a dream, and he told me to come to this farm. You know, the one with the mushroom. Well, I got there, and there was a big hole in the universe. And it was too much for the mushrooms to handle alone. So they sacrificed themselves and passed their powers on to me. Now I'm trying to save John, the homeless guy, from these evil white flowers.
And you... What, you need tobacco for this?
Yeah.
All right, you know what? I know a guy. Let me make a call.
He stepped out of the car and opened his phone, looking through his contacts. I tried to listen in on what he was saying by switching into the mushroom language, where my senses felt enhanced, even though they felt sorely offended by the steel monstrosity in which I found myself.
Hey, Cameron. Yeah. How are you doing, man? Everything cool? Sorry, I know it's late. Today's been a fucking crazy day. Did you see what happened on the news? It was like 10 seconds from my house. I was just getting off work and I stopped at the... Yeah, I am. Sorry. But listen, I just ran into my sister. Yeah, her. Yeah, she did. I don't know what's going on, but she's tripping really bad. She just told me all of this weird shit about some psychic homeless guy, and I think she needs a place to calm down. Oh, you're tripping too? Oh, fuck, dude. Sorry. Well, is it okay if we come by? Thanks, man. You're a lifesaver. I'll head there now. Hey, did you see what happened on the news? Yeah, it was like 10 seconds from my house. Right there, exactly. I went to check it out, and I was about to... Okay, cool.
Jacob opened the door and pulled the car into reverse.
My friend Cameron says he's got some Indian tobacco.
He lied with disturbingly little effort.
Why don't we go down there?
This is serious, Jacob.
I believe you. Don't worry, Meg.
No, you don't.
You heard what I said, didn't you?
I've got mushroom powers, Jacob. Of course I can hear what you said.
How long ago did you take the mushrooms, Megan?
Shut up, Jacob. This is real.
How long ago did you take the mushrooms?
I didn't just... You know what? Stop the car.
No.
Why not?
You're gonna jump out, I'm gonna have to run after you, and it's gonna freak you out because you're tripping balls. That's why.
I'm not gonna jump out, I promise. I want to show you. Rolling his eyes, Jacob pulled over onto the shoulder of the road, almost leaning out into a ditch. He locked the car so that I could not leave. I reached towards his mind and effortlessly pulled him into the mushroom language. Suddenly, the colors in the air became more vivid, shifting just slightly into unreality. His vision became seemingly crystal clear, but the world stretched out of proportion. His head detached from his body and his hands felt miles away from gone. The methamphetamine shooting through his system sent his brain into overdrive. His thoughts ran on never-ending loop. He looked on with horror as time seemed to slip away. Feeling guilty to have hurt him, I switched him into the language of alcohol. At once, all of his fear melted into a depressed, burning haze. His heart rate slowed down. His head started spinning. And his vision went blurry. Then back to English.
What the fuck? What the... Did they do something to you?
No. The mushrooms chose me. They chose me, Jacob. Do you believe me now?
I don't know. Not really. No, I've been up for 3 days, Megan.
Not really?
Don't do that again. Don't.
You recoiled in fear. I'm not gonna. I'm sorry. I know it scared you.
Man, I've gotta quit this shit.
He leaned back in his seat, his heart racing faster than I'd ever seen a heart beat.
That was terrifying.
I'm sorry. Again.
It's not your fault I haven't slept for 3 days. You... The mushrooms gave you, like, the ability to make people trip? Or something?
I can hear the languages of everything. I can hear meth, and alcohol, and acid, and the sleepy drugs at the hospital.
And, like, make people feel them with your mind?
Yeah.
And you're looking for tobacco?
Yeah. But listen, you can't tell anyone you saw me. I'm not supposed to be out here, and I need to hurry back.
Okay. Tobacco, man, I don't know shit about tobacco. If you're looking for meth, I could find you meth. But, like, tobacco... Well, you know, Cameron might actually be able to help. I knew Cameron in high school, and he knows a lot about drugs. I think he took some kind of drug in the Amazon. It started with an I or something. He did it on a volunteer trip. I don't know, he's a Mormon or something.
That's who you were...
Or he was a Mormon before the drugs. He probably has tobacco, if it's...
Amazon. That's who you were talking to?
Yeah, he knows a lot of people. He could probably help you find some Indian tobacco or something.
Jacob pulled back onto the road, not bothering to signal, and floored the accelerator until he reached easily 30 miles per hour over the speed limit.
Where did they take you?
You know, the old water treatment facility everyone thinks has UFOs?
Yeah? Oh shit, there? No way. So were there aliens or anything?
Not really. It's actually just a place where they make satellites and shoot them through wormholes. There's no aliens.
Oh. Okay. Well, that's kinda lame.
Kinda. Jacob's friend Cameron lived outside the city, in a rural subdivision guarded by a gate, with a somewhat bored-looking attendant. Rolling his eyes as Jacob pulled through, the attendant opened the gate, allowing my brother to take off down the dirt road. The house was small, surrounded by thick branches of mesquite and tall trees. A faint smell of marijuana lifted through the air. As we neared the door, I could hear the sounds of David Bowie playing from an old record player. A black light was visible through the door. Cameron sat on the ground, wearing 3D glasses and coloring with crayons.
Whoa! Dude! Oh my god! I was just thinking about birds! Now you're here! Oh, come in, my friend! Oh, teach me!
Wait, never mind, never...
I totally thought you guys were bird gone. Just, alright. What's up, my man?
Not much. Hey, this is my sister Megan. Megan? Cameron.
He kissed my hand and closed the door, looking paranoid as he flicked off the black light and turned on the regular light. A deer's head hung from the wall next to a Pink Floyd poster. The kitchen was stacked with dirty dishes. A half-eaten bowl of ramen sat complacently on the table. Cameron turned down the music.
Sorry, guys. I know that's a little intense. But come on in. Make yourselves at home, guys. And, do you smoke?
Sure,
said my brother. He took a quick hit and then passed it to me. I listened in to the language, shutting my eyes. Before me, there appeared a dazzling swirl of calming green, blue, and purple light. As much as I wanted to get to know marijuana, I needed to focus on tobacco. I passed it to Cameron, not bothering to take a hit.
What are you on, man?
He's on acid.
Well, she got it right. That's crazy. How about you, Megan? Jake told me that you were tripping or something. Are you having a rough time?
I'm not tripping. It's actually really hard to explain.
Yeah, it kind of is.
I did my best, though, and by the time I reached the end of my story, Cameron had gotten back onto his feet to look through his bookshelf.
Wait a second. White flowers. Oh my god. It's like on the tip of my tongue. Oh, okay, here it is. Here it is. Okay. Is this the one you're talking about?
Yeah. What's it called? Datura?
Yeah. Datura strum, strumonium. It's a anti-cholinergic deliriant. It contains scopolamine. I think I've heard of that. Oh, from the bisoculars? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I know someone who tried this once. And, they ended up in the hospital for like 3 days. It's bad shit. It's crazy what happened to your friend, though. But it is kind of amazing. I mean, like, wait. So, you've got mushroom powers.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah, I can totally see it. You've really got this mushroom power vibe. That's amazing. Nice. Hey, before I forget, you, Megan, you need to read this book here. It's called Food of the Gods. It's by Terence McKenna. It's like, you're just, because it's like, you said language, and I'm like, Terence McKenna, and it's like, oh my god, my mind is fucking blown. my mind is fucking blown. And so, I guess you need tobacco to, like, negate the powers of the Datura flower or something like that.
Yeah, but real tobacco. That's what my ancestor said, anyway.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, actually, that makes a lot of sense. You're probably... For real tobacco, what you're probably thinking of is this. I read this book a lot. It's pretty easy for me to find. I'm sorry. You're probably thinking of Nicotiana rustica. It's right here. I read somewhere on the internet a while back that there's like these Indian tribes and they mix tobacco with Datura to kind of like balance the other out.
Do you know where I can find it?
Oh, fuck. You really need this too, and
I have no idea where to find it. Oh my god. So, yeah. How about this? I will go on Reddit for a little bit and Google it and I'll see what I can find. Maybe Arrowhead knows, or I don't know. I'll probably be able to figure it out. I don't know. Do you guys like coloring? You wanna color while I Google?
I exchanged an uncertain look with my brother, who shrugged, feeling slightly too intense and paranoid to be in this house. Sure, I said, getting down on the floor and retrieving a sheet to start coloring.
Okay, cool. I have like 128 colors and all these glitter crayons. Knock yourselves out, guys.
I gently moved aside Cameron's drawing of a bird god and then shifted into the mushroom language. Coloring was a lot better in the mushroom language. I worked on drawing the moon, trying to use as many of the colors as I could. Everything was glowing and squirming, and, you know, generally it was just a good time.
You're doing just fine, Megan,
the moon said in my drawing. It was reassuring. I would hate for the moon to be mad at me. After a few minutes of this, Cameron spun around in his computer and read aloud.
Okay, guys, I think I got something. This is an article. It says that the high concentration in its leaves makes it really useful for making pesticides. So that's maybe there's pesticides based on that around here. I don't know. The other thing I found is over here. There's an old Reddit post, and this person says that they use it to make nicotine gum. I don't know how accurate that is, but I know that I have some nicotine gum. Hey! Are you drawing the moon? Oh my god! That's super cool! I love all those colors.
Thanks. I liked Cameron. I genuinely liked Cameron. He seemed like such a nice person, and he believed everything I'd said. Granted, he was on acid, but that didn't really seem like a big deal now.
Megan, you wanna go?
Oh, wait, guys. I have some here, actually. Nicotine's supposed to be, like, super good for your brain, I read somewhere. I think it is. Man. I don't know. What the fuck even is a brain? Shit. Okay, I'll go look for it.
He stepped out of the room, and I went back to coloring. About 20 minutes later, the sounds of a piano started filling the house. This continued for a while before Cameron shouted,
What did you guys need again?
Nicotine gum?
Ugh. Sorry, I was thinking about brains. It's right here.
Cameron played a few more chords on the piano before running out to meet us. He handed me a box. Can I take this?
Totally. I mean, you gotta save the universe or some shit, right? Yeah. Do it.
Thank you so much. You're so kind.
Oh, thank you. Great to meet both of you guys, and to see you, Jacob. You're both. So beautiful, and I hope that you guys both find peace.
Jacob looked up from his drawing of a skull filled with a giant buzzing city.
Thanks. Are you ready to go, Megan?
Yeah, I'm ready. It was great to meet you. Thanks so much for helping us. Trembling, we left the house, headed towards the woods. The language was difficult to grasp. It eludes me, but deep within the packets of outwardly innocuous gum loomed something great and powerful. My hands began to vibrate as I held onto the package. What little of the plant remained in that box walked into something greater, something universal. This was it. This is it. Is. Somewhere in here is the key to defeating the white flowers and saving the world. As vast as it seems, it is difficult to understand. All of my attempts to learn the language held within results in evasion. I hear the faintest sounds of screeching and moaning, like wails. The more I press into it, the more noise it seems to make. I'm making it upset.
Megan, are you okay?
On your shoulders, on your lips, lips and temporary kiss. Got a jacket, keep you warm, and a kiss to leave you so unsure. Just one, just once, maybe this is what we're looking for. That was nice, maybe twice. Can we get one more? Can we get one more? Call the cab. No, I'm bad. Maybe kissed you more than I should have. Just right, we're just me. You won't answer, you're just leaving. Just one, just one. Maybe this is what we're looking for. That was nice, maybe twice. Can we get one more? Can we get one more? Shot tearing through our conversation. In the dark, we took out our competition. I was greedy, I had to have my fill. We took four shots, and I took the kill. I was greedy, I had to have my fill. But I took the kill. But I took the kill. But I took the kill. But I took the kill.
Wait, there's also a special bonus track at the end of the episode. This was recorded by Colin Estes, and it is a David Bowie sound-alike that I just felt like you all needed to hear the full version of because it's beautiful.
By reproduction and copies of phonographs.
affection. For purposes such as criticism, common news reporting, teaching, reading multiple copies for classroom use, scholarship or research, non-infringement of copyright. Whether the use made of a work in any particular case is a fair use of factors to be considered shall include 1. The purpose and character of use, including whether such use is of a commercial nature.
It over the course of 2 days, and we've covered an awful lot of good ground, and we'll be back probably in late October, I guess, and have another one, but for now this one is happily concluded and another good one in the books.